We'll start today's BPR discussing a guy who told us just after becoming an octogenarian that 80 is the new 20. Mike Dukakis, who yesterday testified on behalf of a young friend of Jahar Tsarnaev, charged with lying to the FBI. Can you imagine any other Paul doing that? Then our food guy, Corby Comer, with a whole new spin on farm-to-table, bringing your pets to restaurants, and his brunch for jerks. We'll ask you. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us for his take on Apple and Facebook's new perk, paying women employees to freeze their eggs.
Our concert roundtable featuring sneak peeks and great sound from the best new music and concerts around town in jazz, classical, and rock and roll. Emily Rooney and her world-famous list of complaints and observations. Then our almost world-famous news quiz featuring two contestants from the Boston Circus Guild. The what? Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. Just doing a little computer thing there. You know, yesterday, Governor Michael Dukakis testified as a character witness in defense of Jahar Tsarnaev's friend, Robel Philippos. Obviously, an esteemed politician took the stand and defended the friend of an alleged terrorist. Governor Mike Dukakis defended a kid who could go to prison for 2 decades in a very controversial case, a kid who was known to have a problem with marijuana. And as bold as this seems in today's sanitized, micromanaged political landscape, I think it's safe to say he would have done this even if he were governor or running for president today. Could you see a politician in the current political environment taking a controversial moral stand on a personal issue that might cause him or her political damage? Have our leaders been so cowed by the media and by re-election fears and so bullied by their handlers that they won't use the bully pulpit to help people they care about? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You know this Philippos kid, not kid, young man, charged, we discussed this the other day, with lying to the FBI, could face a couple of decades in jail. It turns out that Dukakis's wife used to work with the mother of Robel Philippos.
Yeah.
And that's how this all happened.
Well, that's a great line from my colleague Peter Gelsenis in the Herald this morning. He says about Dukakis, the college professor, 3-time governor, and 1-time presidential candidate, stood up for a boy in a huge mess as a favorite to his mother.
I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine something?
No.
I came up with a couple of people who I thought, even if it thought it would cause them political damage, I think John McCain would do it. I think he's the kind of stand-up character, whether one agrees with his politics or not, whether one agrees with Dukakis' politics or not. He seems like the kind of person, I think, who I would guess would be loyal to a friend or a family friend,
even if he took a terrorism case?
Yeah, I think he would.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think that that's what's – this is like nuclear. I mean,
or terrorism-related case. This is – the kid's not accused. The young
right,
man
but
is
it's,
not accused.
But the overall
right,
thing
yes.
is a terrorism case. I'm not sure. Jimmy Carter is the person that comes
yeah,
to
Jimmy
mind.
Yeah, Jimmy Carter would
you know,
really do it.
Jimmy Carter may not have been a great president, but what a great guy he is
yeah,
and how he's done the right
totally
things and
true.
So many things and spoken out in so many great areas. I don't know. What do you think about Bill Clinton?
You're kidding, right? You think Bill Clinton would do something like this?
I don't know.
I would say not. 877-301-8970. Do you find this as remarkable as both Marjorie and I did? We talked on the phone last night about this. I find this – when I heard on the news or saw it – I don't know where I heard this yesterday – that former Governor Dukakis, who, by the way, will be with us in late November, November 21st in studio, was going to testify. I wasn't aware of the relationship at all between the Philippos family and him. And in fact, if you obviously we didn't hear the testimony, as we know, it's in a federal courtroom. The governor spoke yesterday outside the federal courthouse. He said when Robel Philippos' mother couldn't get in touch with him, meaning with Robel after the marathon bombings, she asked the former governor to call her son.
And I called him and he answered. And I said, what's going on? Where are you? And he told me that he had been in Worcester, that the FBI questioned him for 5 hours. And I said, well, what'd you tell him? He said, I was so confused, I don't know what I told him. So I said, well, call your mother, will you? She's very concerned.
You know, even is so matter of fact. It's like, well, this. Did you read that he took this young man? This is what 10 years ago,
Democratic Convention,
when he was 10 years old, to the Democratic Convention
when John Kerry was nominated to see it. Yeah, and that he and this woman was a friend of Kitty Dukakis, and they were both working as social workers, dealing with people that were coming from foreign countries and stuff like that. You know what the other thing to me is so startling about Dukakis? I don't want to go overboard here because everybody has an ego that's a politician, but compared to other politicians. I mean, I've told the story before. Michael Dukakis leaves his home on Perry Street, walks northeastern, and on the way he picks up trash.
And how do you know that, Marjorie?
Because I followed him one day, and this is, he's 80 now. He must have been like 70 at the time. And I'm thinking, gosh, if this 70-year-old guy can be picking up some trash, I should be picking up some trash too. The two of us are picking up trash on the way to northeastern. But I only did it because I felt, you know, he's older than I am. I should be helping out. But the thing is. Can you imagine another politician? I mean, politicians usually are in rarefied air. You know, they're riding around in their big cars and they never have to worry about a parking space or paying a parking ticket or half the time not even pay for a meal because people pay for them in these situations. Michael Dukakis, relatively speaking, is an egoless guy. And I think that's what's remarkable. He took the tea, as he always does, down to the federal courthouse.
Well, but that's a political stance because he actually believes in mass transit.
Yeah, and walked up to the courthouse with no, you know, all by himself. You saw the picture of him all by himself.
I know.
Marches up there, goes in and takes a stand for 15 minutes and will get trashed in many quarters for standing up for a guy that is being accused of being a
abettor.
But he wasn't.
But we should be clear about that. No one is suggesting that he had anything to do with, nor did he know. This is Philippos.
What he's accused of is being lying repeatedly to the federal government, and that is the FBI, which, of course, didn't record the conversation, so we don't really know what happened in those conversations.
But lying about what happened after the disposal of the backpack by some of their friends
Lying about being in the room and lying about overhearing the conversation when they were talking about disposing of the backpack. Our number is 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Is he unusual? I mean,
is he unusual? Why do you think both of us reacted like if this were the norm, if people took personal risks and political risks in politics all the time? I mean, other than the fact that he was the former governor of our state, I don't think I would have blinked. It is so. I am sure somebody listening will either text us, tweet us, call us, and tell us that they can think of other examples. I have to say, I am hard pressed. To come up, you know, the most recent politician. What's the name of the governor of Virginia who was just convicted of corruption? And what did he do in his trial? Threw his wife under the bus in an attempt to get himself exonerated.
You know what his nickname was before we found out about this? It was Governor Vaginal Probe because he was the one that wanted all women going to get abortions to have vaginal probes before the fact. But that did not fly in West Virginia. 877 – not West Virginia, Virginia. 877-301-8970. What do you think of about Michael Dukakis going down to testify in a trial for a young man, the admitted stoner, who said he was so stoned he didn't remember what happened. And the optics were great. There was a whole line of stoners that took the stand before Dukakis. So they were talking about bongs and vaporizers and getting high in the car with the windows rolled up. And then Dukakis marches down there. He's got his blue blazer on and his red tie. And I think he had a pair of gray slacks on, dressed up for the occasion, takes a stand. He didn't know about the bongs and the vaporizers, but he did know about this young man's history because he was like a family friend, a mentor to him.
So do you see this as much of an outlying kind of thing as Marjorie and I quite obviously do? Let's start in Alston with Kevin. Kevin, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
First of all, Bob McDonald, former governor of Virginia.
Right.
He actually, you know, being from Virginia originally, I swear this is my question or thought, he actually did originally strike down the vaginal probe. It was brought in by the Virginia House of Delegates. And he actually came out against it, but then backpedaled. But that's
okay. Well, thanks for the history. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I think it's great. You know, Dukakis can say, and I completely agree with everything about his character. And I think, you know, this definitely wasn't a political stunt. I do have to say, though, I think it is easier because hasn't been on a ballot since 1988.
Oh, sure.
You know, I'm not saying that. You know, I feel like he is the kind of person. Would he still do it? I don't know. But let's say that he was on the ballot this year or he was stumping for a candidate who was on the ballot this year. This might be a completely different, you know.
Can I tell you something? Obviously, it's all hypothetical. And I don't know. It isn't like he's a personal friend of mine, but I know him a little bit. I have zero doubt, Kevin. I have zero doubt that he would do exactly the same thing he did. The only difference is if he was still governor or was running for president, there'd be huge numbers of press people as opposed to a handful of press people. But in, at least in my judgment, that's the kind of character he is. I mean, and the kind of character he has.
I see that. I see that.
Kevin, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You know, it's the only thing that's unfortunate about this, even though it makes the point even better, is the young man is charged with what on paper is a fairly serious offense. So, it, you know, it tempers certain things. But the flip side is it makes his showing up even more dramatic. That he, I mean, I can't, not a second thought kind of thing is
no,
at least the sense.
And
he's the one who called the young man to find him.
Yes, to find him and said, please call your mother. She's worried about you. And what happened? And that was at that point that Filippos tells him he was questioned for 5 hours by the FBI, but was so confused he didn't know what he told him. And that, by the way, is his defense, that he was in a marijuana stupor and couldn't remember what he said or what he didn't say. And I am enraged about the fact that we don't really know what anybody said, since we don't have any record of these conversations, because the FBI, unlike other people, doesn't record their conversations.
And by the way, just to make correction, I said he could serve more than 2 decades. What actually is the maximum sentence in this? You corrected me during the sound.
According to this morning's Boston Globe, he is charged with 2 counts of lying, each carrying a maximum 7-year prison term, so 14 years.
Let's go to Gary and Peabody. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Gary.
Hi, how are you, Jim?
Excellent.
This message, this question goes out to Marjorie.
What?
She's right here.
Marjorie, Jerry Remy stood up for his son, and you wanted him to lose his job.
Well, I think that that was a very different case, Hank, because what was going on there...
Gary,
I'm sorry. Hank is the next guy. Gary, is that if you read the record, he was arrested, his son, 19 times. And after brutalizing 4 different young women, one with a baby in her hand. So I think at that point you have to recognize you're not helping your son by enabling him to continue in his life of crime, that there's a problem there that needs to be addressed. And so I found it very difficult to look at the father after this, because a woman's dead.
You were I thought you were joking, Guy. You're comparing Jared Remy to Robel Filippos, even if he's guilty of everything that he's charged with, the worst that he did, which I'm not minimizing the significance of, is lying to the FBI. Jared Remy murdered the mother of his child in cold blood after brutalizing women before. It's sort of not the same thing, right?
Well, no, I'm not comparing the crimes. I'm just comparing the loyalty of somebody standing up for somebody, Cox, stand up guy, and throw Jerry under the bus.
Yeah, well,
we just disagree. We just disagree, Gary. I don't think that Jerry Remy was doing a stand-up thing by his son. I think he was enabling him to do what he did, which is slaughter somebody in front of his child. So
well, it's not just about his son.
If I can disagree,
if I can weigh in on this, I think if Robel Filippos is either freed at the end of this trial or in 14—well, it wouldn't be 14 years, whatever number of years—I don't think most people see him as a threat to society. Any sane person, including a parent, would have seen Jared Remy, I think. But Gary, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. Joe from New Bedford, I don't know how we heard from him, he may have tweeted us, thinks Tom Menino, who has a new book, by the way, and will be with us later this month, he would have done that. What do you think?
He might have. I'm trying to think back in his administration where he stood up for people that were under the gun. Well, I tell you what he did do. I take this back.
Gay rights.
Gay rights. Absolutely.
Long before anybody else.
He was very early on with gay rights when he paid a political price for it. So, yeah, he would have stood up for in a situation like this.
Well, you know, you said that before that Mike Dukakis, and I agree with you, is a pretty humble character considering what he's done and where he's been. But it really requires, and I mean this in the pejorative, a certain level of arrogance to basically say, I don't give a you-know-what the public thinks. This is the right thing to do. And there's a piece of that. In Tom Menino,
yeah. And there's a piece of it in Michael Dukakis, too.
Yeah.
I think he did a lot of unpopular things and popular things when he was governor, because he thought they were the right things to do. And you know, I think he thought sometimes my way or the highway, and people criticized him for that. But post his office, and sometimes for some of the things he did when he was in his office, I really liked the guy. Anyway, let's go to Hank in Marlborough. I mixed you up before. Hi, Hank.
Hello, Hank.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Which of Marjorie's columns do you want to criticize, Hank? Go, I'm kidding. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I had an opportunity to hear Hillary Clinton speak this week at a conference in California, and she talked about the impact of Citizens United and the fact that senators spend on average about 5 hours a day not legislating, but rather earning raising money. And so I think there's a bigger, broader impact. I think what Dukakis did was amazing, but I think there's a bigger, broader impact, which is it's not so much the decision of the politician, it's the decision of their backers, because it's all about the money. And if you cross your sponsors, you lose your sponsors.
You know, Hank, that is perfect. And obviously he doesn't have handlers now, but talking about people who are currently in politics, it's totally true. In my opinion, the stories are legion of politicians who have made statements or done things or not done things, which to me run totally counter to what they believe in their heart, that in many cases cost them. The most dramatic example I can think of is John Kerry, who obviously came to fame because of his principled opposition to a war he served in, then supporting a war that, because people like Bob Shrum, his advisor, said you can't get elected president if you oppose the Iraq war. And look what happened. He was not elected president.
The second person, obviously, is the woman Hank called about, Hillary Clinton. I think she supported the Iraq war, too. And I'm not sure it was in her heart to support the Iraq war.
She now says biggest mistake she ever made.
Yeah.
Hank, thanks for the call.
877-301-8970 is the number. What do you think about Mike Dukakis walking down, the former governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, walking down in this unassuming way, going to the federal courthouse all by himself, taking the stand after these bunch of little stoners, one after another, to talk about mentoring, basically, this young man who's now on trial and facing 14 years for lying to federal authorities about what happened in the days following the Boston Marathon massacre. 877-301-8970.
And we're not just asking your opinion about Dukakis. We're asking you if you think there are other people. We'd love to praise them because we're generally damning politicians on this show. People in American politics now or in recent times who you think would have done this. By the way, Bob from Arlington apparently tweeted and said, good for Dukakis. At least he didn't do it from a tank.
Oh, God.
You know, there's certain things that you never, ever get over. And my guess is if Mike Dukakis was standing here and we just read that tweet, he probably would have... He would have laughed.
Well, you know, it's funny. The second one that was almost as bad but didn't get nearly as much play was the picture of John Kerry coming out of this tube looking like a sperm. He was in a sperm costume. You know, it was like in that Woody Allen movie when the sperm were...
Everything you want to know about sex, you're afraid to ask.
But for some reason... it didn't capture the imagination the way the tank
That was
did.
A Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy or whatever it was called at that time in Florida, I think. It is a classic photo.
It is a classic, yeah. Let's go to Bill in the car. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Bill.
Hi there. How are you?
Excellent.
Jim,
thank
I'm Bill Kelly, Ed Kelly's brother. We work together.
Oh, Bill, it is so, so nice to hear from you, and I miss him. Hi, Bill.
Well, very nice to talk to you. I was thinking of John Adams, who was the only person who was willing to stand up and defend the British soldiers after the Boston Massacre.
Mm.
Wait, that's going back into history. So I guess we have to go back to how many years is that?
230 years or something to find somebody.
And that was early in his career. That was not somebody who was 80 years old. That was early in his career before he ran for public office. He was willing to put himself on the line for that.
Oh, speaking of history, here's one, Bill and Jim.
Yes, Jim.
We talked about this many times before. Who's FDR that? Saying that he welcomed the hatred of the big banks and Wall Street during the Depression. That was pretty courageous.
Well, except one might argue, and I'm not taking anything away from him, particularly after having watched much of the 14 hours or whatever it was of the Roosevelts, one would argue with this as being a populist president, if anything, that probably helps you rather than hurts you. The banks may not love you for it, but
I haven't seen our current president stand up to Wall Street in any
way. Well,
and it's his second
Bill,
term.
Thanks for the call. It's great
can
to hear from you.
Can he afford to do it
Thank
now?
You.
Thank
What's
you for
that?
Calling, Bill.
Well, people say that about a lot of things. Forget personal things that put you at risk. Is why don't you go for broke on virtue? And by the way, after the election, he's going to do something that's going to give him huge criticism when he does this executive order that could end up providing what critics will call amnesty, what he will call as a path to
citizenship.
Well,
he can take the criticism. He doesn't have to run again.
Well, I hope so. I hope that's the case.
Paul is nominating Mike Dukakis for U.S. Attorney General. He's impressed.
Well, you know, a lot of people thought, in fact, someone wrote a column in the Globe, I can't remember who it was, that Mike Dukakis should have been the interim senator. You remember when Mo Cowan was appointed by Governor Patrick to fill the
would have been very nice.
Spot? Yeah.
Let's go to Mark in Boston. What do you think, Mark?
Hi, Mark.
Well, hey, guys. Well, I just wanted to say that obviously this Dukakis thing is very noble of him. But I'm reminded immediately of a modern politician today. Charlie Baker, actually. I remember a couple months ago, during this whole underage immigration stuff, contrary to what you probably expect from Republicans, like, he basically sided with Duvall can embrace the idea of taking care of
That is taking the kids who had come across the border unaccompanied. That is
He took a lot of crap for that, too, especially from, like, the right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it was the right thing to do, and I think a lot of other people would agree.
Yeah, Mark, that was really a counterintuitive position from Charlie Baker, who, of course, is running for governor. Jim and I saw serving. We all announced we're doing a debate on Tuesday night.
Is that Tuesday?
Tuesday night.
Tuesday.
I thought it was at 8. It's at 7 o'clock, 7 actually. O'clock. 7 o'clock, yes.
By the way, Mark, thanks for the call. By the way, I want to say one thing which I wasn't going to disclose, but since you brought it up and just said what you said.
Are you going to confess what you did, Jim?
No, I'm not going to confess what I did. I'm going to confess what you did.
Noble move. What did I do?
We have the first one-on-one debate on GBH and also sponsored by the Boston Globe Tuesday night. Marjorie, 2 days ago, we're sitting at our desk reading some material that our colleagues have prepared for us to help us get ready for Tuesday night. What did you say to me, Marjorie?
I said the debate's Thursday night, right?
No, you did not. You said, this is Tuesday, right? It's not quite that bad, but it was bad enough.
Okay, I wasn't sure. Okay. Anyway,
but you know it is Tuesday now,
I know it's
right?
Tuesday. Fine, I thought it was at 8. Now I know it's at 7, so I'll be here on time.
Excellent.
Up next, bringing your pets to restaurants gives a whole new meaning to the farm-to-table movement. Corby Cummer joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm laughing already. I'm Jim Browdy, not at you, Corby, and she's Marjorie Egan. So is brunch, quote, a symptom of the soulless suburban conformity that is relentlessly colonizing our urban environments? Or is brunch, quote, falling out of fashion like a pair of bell-bottoms? Is brunch for jerks? These are the questions that David Shaftel asked in his recent New York Times piece, Brunch is for Jerks. It's called Corby Cummer has a highly sensitive jerk meter, from what we understand. We'll ask him about this and other topics from the culinary world. Corby, as you know, is an award-winning food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic. Hello there, Corby.
Hi there.
Okay, before we get to my favorite story of the last 6 weeks and test your jerk-o-meter or whatever it is over there, Corby, I want to know about this exciting development in Boston, this public food market down by the Rose Kennedy Greenway. What's the deal?
Gosh, I'm excited about that.
Me too.
I've been just for about 3 years now, I've been looking. How is it doing? Is the financing coming through? In my own Jamaica Plain, the various heads of the organizations trying to raise money for it have been working tirelessly for about 3 years on it. And just the other day, there was the groundbreaking for it. So it's going to be 28,000 square feet. It's at Haymarket. It will never erase the confusion between the kind of awful second-rate produce there is at Haymarket, but at
least... Is it awful second-rate produce?
Well, it's inexpensive and affordable, so I'm always for that. But it comes from the Chelsea wholesalers from all over the country, and it's, you know, not local particularly.
Okay.
It's not particularly high quality. What's good is it's right there in the center of Boston. It's available, and it looks good. But finally, we're going to have actual local produce from local farmers and food marketers. And there's places all around the country that have tried to do this, but in a northeastern climate where it snows and rains, a 12-month market's almost unheard of. They failed in Portland. There always have been philanthropists who have decided, we're going to try to open this, like a woman from the Maine banking, MBNA in Portland, who did a beautiful indoor market that failed.
But wait a second, I hadn't thought about this till you said it. I'm excited as you two are.
Yeah.
But how do they do it in the dead of winter? I assume most of these, I mean, cows are still cowing or whatever they do. But, I don't know what the verb is.
What do they do out there?
Exactly.
Well,
I do know what they do. But how do they do it? How is produce local in December and January?
So when you think about it, or if you go and ask local chefs who care an enormous amount about getting local produce, even in the dead of winter, they will say, you know, you're looking at a lot of turnips, but you're looking at a lot more now. There's winter storage fruit. Verifarms and others have pooled together resources to have really good state-of-the-art, very cold but not frozen storage, so you can get apples, turnips, beets, root vegetables that have been stored, some of which over winter, kale, our favorite vegetable of the year. You can get it all winter, and there are more and more greenhouses that work throughout the winter called hoop houses that use minimal amounts of heat but manage to produce actual produce in the ground, lettuce, microgreens, all winter long.
Is this privately owned or is this a city deal? Who owns this thing?
What a good question. So it's gotten a lot of money from the state agriculture department and some from the city, and mostly from philanthropists. So really? It's been a private fundraising organization. There's been a board that's had varying rates of success and now is going great guns. So it's many millions of dollars. It's been years in the making. And finally, it looks like it's going to open next summer.
But it's also going to be baked goods, seafood, poultry. It's going to be
great.
The answer to Jim's question. What do you do all year round when there's not fresh produce? You have many kinds of locally produced things like pies, like pastries, like nuts, like processed meats, like fish. Jared Auerbach from Red's Best, which is a national leader in allowing very small fishermen to widely distribute very fresh fish through these really innovative ways of delivering in software.
Kirby, what are microgreens?
Microgreens. I'm so glad you asked. So, they look like baby greens. They're little tiny lettuces. They're easy to grow. They grow all winter.
Oh, really?
You can get them in Japanese herbs, salads, lamb's lettuce, arugula.
Ooh.
All these things that are available all winter, really, and grow in New England.
Yeah, speaking of local and great, another thing that really excited me, a story we read this week, is that when I lived in New York City, I moved decades ago, but before I moved, I used to have seltzer delivered, and those old seltzer bottles, like you'd see in Marx Brothers things, it was $1 a bottle. They deliver them in those great wood cases. It was fabulous. I assume milk delivery was totally a thing of the past, but actually there are a handful, five, six firms, at least in eastern Massachusetts, I'm not sure exactly where, that still deliver milk to your house for affordable rates?
Again, I have to concentrate on Jamaica Plain, the center of the universe, but look in Arlington, look in Cambridge, you'll see these silver milk boxes from Thatcher Farms or Crescent Ridge Dairy. So they're great services, and the enormous trucks that still look like 1950s hulks. They're painted silver, and they come down the way, and up goes the milkman with bottles. So it's the greatest thing to see these. And just as even when I was growing up, they would offer things like muffins and chocolate milk and things you don't expect them to have, but it widens out the retail line. Now, what Thatcher Farms, which is based in Milton, which is why I see a lot of it in JP because it's right next door.
Oh, you're connected to JP? I didn't know
that.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. So they come around and they deliver lots of different things, but it's not their own dairy anymore because Milton long ago became a bedroom community. So they can't afford to have dairy land. They watched all their dairy in the 60s be eaten up by subdivisions. So it comes from New Hampshire. So it's a way of distributing local milk. I think Crescent Farms is the same way. They're like co-ops.
But besides the sort of nostalgia, if you can remember back to when you used to get the milk at the back door, what's the advantage to the consumer? I mean, because you're going to go to the supermarket anyway. It's not such a big deal to pick up some extra milk.
Oh, I would say giving business to local places that are gathering together local farmers.
Okay.
So I know that Thatcher Farms does something that's terrific, which is it does vat pasteurization, which is – we won't go into the big technical difficulties between continuous pasteurization and that sort of batch at a time, but it's at a lower temperature that allows in much more flavor.
Oh.
It has a 2-week shelf life instead of 7 to 8 weeks, and it has more flavor. So there's a chance that you're actually getting milk with a lot more flavor.
Okay.
Also, doesn't it taste better in glass bottles than
plastic?
I love the
think so.
Is it the price is competitive or not?
They're a little higher.
But
are
not
competitive.
Ridiculous.
No, not ridiculous.
You know what's the best thing was the little thing of cream at the top?
That's the very best thing.
Yeah, I love that when you get the cream.
So it's called cream line or cream top milk, and I don't know if Thatcher Farms does it, but it's just the best thing in the world. It feels like this big treat somebody
gave.
Yeah,
it does.
How do you, besides Thatcher, well, two quick questions, Corby Comer. One, how do you find these places? I mean, Thatcher you'd find by name. How do you find the other handful that are doing it?
Go online, do milk delivery, go to Edible Boston, which did a long service piece on what local dairies will do home delivery. The Globe just did a piece this week concentrating on Crescent Ridge. So if you look them up online, bought milk home delivery.
The other – I mentioned seltzer in New York City. The good news was I got in before they ran out of bottles. The bad news was if you didn't get in, all my envious friends said, how do you sign up? And you call the place and say, we just don't have enough bottles. We need somebody to drop out of the home delivery thing before we can add you. Are there enough thick, old, or great glass bottles, or are these new and they have capacity that's enough to add new customers?
So I haven't looked into which glass manufacturers are doing this, but it's definitely a trend all over New England and New York. When you go to Boston, New York, fancy places, you see milk in bottles. So somebody is producing them. And then you collect them as vases because you don't ever bring them back to the store the way you're supposed to because you just forget. But indeed, there doesn't seem to be a shortage, and more artisan dairies are finding bottles.
So let's move on to another one of my favorite stories. I got this email yesterday. I opened it up, and there was a picture of this pig in a stroller next to, like, this tea tray at the Four Seasons Hotel. I said, what the heck is this?
Wait, before he answers, what did our colleague Chelsea call this morning?
Well, she said this gives new meaning to
farm to table. So what is this thing?
So my friend Patty Marks, Patricia Marks, a very funny writer, maybe the funniest in the country. Let's just say it on this show and decide she's the funniest writer in the country. She writes for The New Yorker, and they assigned her to do a piece about emotional care animals. And what can you get away with claiming that you need emotional care animals? So in these outlandish situations, she printed out a letter from a licensed social worker saying, it is my professional opinion that Patricia Marks, for her well-being, requires the use of an emotional care animal in public places. I hope you'll extend her the courtesy of allowing the accompaniment of this animal. And as she starts out her piece, in this day of the internet, you can print out anything you want that looks official. So she brandishes this letter in these ridiculous places. Like, she brings a turkey. Turkeys aren't emotional support animal. She brings it on the Hampton Jitney for a while, doesn't actually go to the Hamptons, gets off before it leaves New York, and then she brings it to Katz's Deli downtown and orders a turkey sandwich. She does these really awful things.
She is the funniest writer in America.
She has a snake that's this beautiful snake, and she somehow bonds with a snake, surprisingly. It seems, very benign and friendly, and she wears it like a necklace. And she brings it into Christian Louboutin on Madison Avenue and says, I need a snakeskin purse to go with it. And they actually say which colors bring out the snake and which clash with it. So she has these very funny things. But there's a very serious underlying point, which is, does anyone really legitimately need this? And by pranksters like her printing out phony letters and plastering emotional care animal, as there was on this stroller with a pig in it, are they robbing credibility of the people who actually need them?
And yes.
So did you go to the Four Seasons with her and the pig?
It was my idea.
And you went to the Four Seasons with the pig and this Marks one.
The idea was to take tea at the Ritz. As we know, the Ritz hardly offers it anymore, like twice a week in months without an R in them, and you have to make a reservation.
Which is so sad because it was one of the great things
you
could do with
your little
girls.
They long ago gave up Cinnamon Toast, which was the greatest loss to Boston. They don't even know what Cinnamon Toast is when you go.
It was one of the great kid things,
one
I have
of the great
to say.
Things.
My youth.
Sorry, adult, too.
Well, okay.
For some of us.
So wait a second. So what happened? You went in with the pig.
So we went in with the pig, and the nice woman at the Four Seasons, which specializes in niceness, said, you can't bring that thing in here. She said it in a very nice way. And Patty showed her the letter and said, with this urgency, as she always did, it's an emotional care animal. And so the woman looks at the letter and says, well, as long as my manager knows I saw a letter, go ahead. So
Hold on. Was the pig on a leash? And
no.
Did you walk in or carry the pig?
The pig was in a baby stroller.
In the baby stroller, the whole time in the stroller. Okay.
Which is the way its owner, this really funny young woman who seemed to have had a past in butchering, which she has given up, and wanted to have pigs, pet pigs. And Patty,
she's the funniest former butcher in America, by the
way,
that woman got.
Patty went on Craigslist and said, pet pigs – rent for a day. And she found this woman in New Jersey. So they took the plane up from Newark, the U.S. Air Shuttle. And
with the pig in the shuttle?
And they got through security. So it was all this brandishing this letter and bringing it on the plane. And evidently the stewardesses, they were actual women, would
– We call them flight attendants. The flight, 2014.
Thank you so much, Jim. Okay, the flight attendants actually applauded and said, oh, I want my picture. Because the phenomenon everywhere was everybody wanted selfies with this pig. So we were on the Boston Common. Everybody came up and oohed and aahed when we were taking the pig out for a stroll. But it was in the stroller when we approached the maitre d' at the Four Seasons. And so she said, okay, got the letter. My manager knows there was a letter. So in we go. And as we're rolling up to the table, I ask a waiter who happens to be strolling by, so have you ever seen one of these in here before? And he says, without missing a beat, not on 4 feet. Which is like the greatest line
funniest waiter ever lived. Okay, so wait a second. But her piece is called Pets Allowed, Why Are So Many Animals Now in Places Where They Shouldn't Be? By Patricia Marks and the New Yorker. The other theme is the whole notion, we only have a minute for this, about taking pets to restaurants. Every time I mention Western Europe, Marjorie like says, oh, Jim was... But when you go to Western Europe, you go to outdoor restaurants and
they're
dogs sitting at the table with their owners. It is... gross to me. What's your take on that?
That probably there should be a legitimate reason that these animals accompany a person. And I think that city health departments go through tortures about this. And they did for emotional care.
Well, that's a different – I mean legitimate emotional care, not
well,
the pig.
I mean,
or the,
how much legitimate emotional sustenance are you getting from a turkey?
Well, that was a joke, Marjorie.
Right.
I'm not talking about a turkey.
No, I know. But I mean the turkey passed muster, the turkeys in the turkey sandwich store.
No, that I can't comment on. But what I can say is that the health department in New York and Boston outlawed, said no, only care dogs for the blind. They just drew the line on that. Now, they understood it's an animal in a restaurant. Why are you saying it is legitimate, whereas other trained animals, how are they going to be any better or worse behaved? But that's where they drew the line because it's so well established. They're service dogs. They're specially trained.
I have one last question before we leave the subject. What was this like for the pig? Did the pig seem to be okay,
wheeled
around on the stroller, or was the pig squealing, or what was it?
No,
it had a ham sandwich. Marjorie, is that what you want to hear? Is that where you're going with this, or what?
No, there was the turkey sandwich at Katz's with a turkey. No, there were none of these little pranks. It was very excited by the food because of its sense of smell, which is why I snapped this picture that the New Yorker wound up using. Little did I know I would make my photographic debut in the pages of the New Yorker. And it got pretty close to the food, and it wanted that food, but its owner had fed it. You know, you make sure that these things are fed, that you're not torturing or depriving.
Okay. This guy is defending a pig.
So
at
it wasn't
Four
upset.
Seasons.
The pig was not upset.
Who cares about the pig, Marjorie?
I do care about
we
the
all
pig.
Cared about the pig, as we know they're enormously intelligent animals.
They
you
are.
Read Charlotte's Web, Jim.
Oh,
yes.
That pig was
did
unbelievable.
Did they like to be petted like dogs?
They were okay being, was okay being petted.
He doesn't know. Okay, before you leave, we're going to discuss this with listeners in a couple of minutes. Marjorie and I love this piece.
I do.
It was in the October 10th New York Times by David Sheftel. It's called Brunches for Jerks. The opening line is, it's over, I'm through with brunch. What's this guy's thesis, and do you agree with it?
You know, I don't agree with it, and I'm glad that you like it so much, and here's going to be the contrary argument.
But go ahead.
Before I get to that, here's the guy's thesis. There's a bunch of entitled jerks without kids saying that it's okay to wake up with a hangover and go and drink all day and torment the lives of actual passersby, hardworking parents in neighborhoods that used to own that neighborhood and used to feel this was a safe place not to be tormented by sockless, loafer-wearing yuppies who are complete jerks and flaunting their lack of child care and their disposable income and their inability to use their time to better society.
So why do you disagree with that?
Because I think it's giving business to restaurants and it's bringing people together in person as opposed to in online chat rooms.
There you go.
And it's actually fostering human contact. And that is becoming increasingly rare. And I like seeing people getting together over the table. And if this is a habit that is going to be very difficult to maintain once they grow up and use their time wisely and responsibly and better society, and they have kids so that they have no sleep and they're deprived all the time, I hope they'll try to invite each other over to each other's houses, watching the kids, and still come together over food.
Now I feel bad. I mean,
I've changed my position.
No, I feel horrible about my position.
Absolutely. We both have been chastised.
What's the best brunch place in town before you go, Corby Comer?
Oh, I'm a sucker for hotel brunches. There's
so am I.
Because I just like those
buffets.
So name
me
one.
Too.
They're absolutely lethal, but I really like them, and I'm very tempted by them. I go straight for the salad, and I think, free food. Of course, it's not free, but
no,
it seems like it is free. Mike and Patty's in Bay Village is a place that people love going. Tony Maw's at Craigie Street Bistro in Cambridge actually shows up and cooks brunch. We can't go into Gordon Hammersley without crying, but he's somebody who actually would show up and cook eggs on Sunday, a star chef. I think that maybe Sarma in Somerville is doing brunch. So, you know, local restaurants that do this, it's great to be able to go and hang out with real people over real food.
So you have humiliated both me and Margaret.
Well, not intentionally.
But it's a pleasure to see you.
We're going to have to figure out how to do another 180 during the break here. Corby Comer, thank you, as always, for coming in. And good for you for going to the Four Seasons with a pig. You're
I'm bringing
braver,
a pig
man.
To the show on Monday. Let's see how that works out.
Okay.
Good to see you, Corby.
Corby's an award-winning food writer and a senior editor at The Atlantic. Coming up, we're going to ask you guys, is brunch for jerks? Corby says no. Jim and I said yes. I don't know. We flip-flopped here a little bit. But we're certain anyone who works in a restaurant has an opinion about this, or anybody who's spent a lot of time going to brunches in Greenpoint in Brooklyn. We're taking your calls. You can stick up for brunch or savage it next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Now it's your turn, and time is short. So if you want to get in on this, do it now. Is brunch for jerks? We're asking you. I said it's the subject of this recent, I thought, brilliant piece by David Shaftel. Here's what he says. Shaftel characterizes the brunch industrial complex, as he calls it, that rumbles to life every weekend. Quote, by late morning, crowds of brunchers, often hungover and probably bedraggled, begin to assemble, eager to order from rote menus featuring some variation of mimosas and eggs benedict. Our number is 877-301-8970. Is he right? Is brunch for jerks? Is this great Sunday tradition now just become overrated, just offensive and effete and all these things? And I used to love brunch, my favorite meal ever when I was growing up.
Of course.
I'm with the author.
Well, that's his point, that when you're young and shiftless, you can go out there with
shiftless.
Your disposable income before you have any children to tie you down. You can spend 15 hours, you know, drinking all day long. Here's the downsides to brunch, to rebut what Corby said, or the good sides, that according to this guy that's writing the New York Times, that chefs bury the dregs of the week's dinners under rich sauces. Kind of everything is floating in béarnaise sauce or egg. What's the stuff on Eggs Benedict?
Hollandaise sauce.
He says that the brunchers are very rude to the servers and they don't give them good enough tips. The whole place looks like the rerun of Friends or Sex in the City. You probably didn't watch Sex in the City. It was kind of a girl thing. But they were always going out together
in Sex in the City
to have their meals and talking about their problems with men and stuff like that. And, you know, he did mention in this piece that even his local Thai restaurant wants to get in on the brunch craze, so they top every Thai dish with a poached egg on the weekends. I don't know how good that would taste.
I'm not worried about the food, frankly. It's the people thing. Our number is 877-301-8970. A million great quotes in the story. My favorite is from this guy, Julian Casablancas. He's the lead singer of a group called The Strokes. He has moved out of New York City for an unnamed upstate locale because, quote, I don't know how many like white people having brunch I can deal with on a Saturday afternoon. That's another point the author. It used to be a Sunday morning tradition. I like traditions like
every
that.
Day.
Now it's all day Saturday and all day Sunday. 877-301, forgot for a second, 8970. 877-301-8970. Is this author right that brunch is for jerks, or is Corby Comer right that it is still a great humanitarian, collegial way to spend a weekend morning?
Well, I must say, I do enjoy going to brunch in Boston, but one of my kids lives in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint.
New York,
that's so hip and trendy, and it's like everything's total farm to table. So I've gone out to brunch with her a couple of times, and first of all, you feel like no matter what you wear, you were the biggest hayseed in the
whole
joint.
That's the point.
Everybody looks gorgeous. Everybody is dressed to kill, and the menus are all full of these foods. You don't really understand what they are because it's so hip. They're talking about micro greens and those things that Corby Cummer knows about because he's a food expert. I'm looking at this menu, can't figure out what the hell I'm doing. And you just feel as though you kind of drop down there from another planet, and you're just, like I said, just old, hayseedy, and out of touch.
So, and let me just be clear before we get to the calls. In 10 minutes, you've gone from yes, brunch is for jerks to no, it hasn't, because Corby convinced you.
That's right.
To back, yes,
I'm
it
easily,
is.
I'm easily persuaded, Jim.
Let's take a few calls. We don't have much time, so we'll try to squeeze as many in as we can. Let's go to Bob. You're in Arlington. Hi, Bob.
Hi. How are you today?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I hope I'm not going to upset your producer now because she told me she lived in Arlington.
It's okay.
Great. There's a couple of great restaurants here in Arlington, pretty high end, and they have brunches Saturday and Sunday, and there's always a line of people to get in.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I've noticed every time I walk by there, they've got floor to ceiling windows, you know, beautiful view of the street. They don't take off their sunglasses. It's the only meal I've seen people, they don't take off their sunglasses.
Yeah.
And the point that your last guest made about
Corby, yeah.
Brings people together and they can chat. Well, they just text each other across the table.
Well, yeah, you captured the spirit of this New York Times piece perfectly, Bob. Thank you for the call.
Right?
Yeah.
You know the other thing about brunch is?
They're texting each other at the table.
It's cheaper. I mean, basically, how much can you charge for Eggs Benedict? You know what I mean? It's not like going out for dinner when you have like scallops.
The answer is you can charge a huge amount of money for a Sunday brunch.
$35 or $40
But you buy drinks. Ordinarily, people don't drink alcoholic beverages at breakfast.
The buffets are more expensive. But, you know, when you're having waffles and breakfast stuff.
You're generally not having waffles with sunglasses on while you're texting the person at your table.
Really, what are you having at brunch,
what?
Jim? What are you?
I'm not having anything anymore because I agree with this character. Let's go to Framingham where Merrill is on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Merrill.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
We're excellent. Well, I'm excellent. She is, too. Hi. What's going on?
Well, I just want to say I love your show. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you.
I've been saying that brunch is for jerks pretty much forever, mostly because I hate standing in line for something that I could cook myself in a couple minutes now. Once in a while, a brunch out with friends is very nice, but I can't stand people who waste time standing in line.
What was Yogi Berra's great line? It's so busy that no one goes there anymore, or whatever. It's so crowded, no one goes there anymore. But I have to say that's part of the problem, and maybe that's not fair. I'm with you, Merle. It has become so popular and so chic to do the brunch thing that you have to stand in line forever to have a meal. That's not fun. I'm with you, Merle. The only place
I was before saying people should get together and have brunch at home. It's fun, and it's frankly not that hard to do.
Well, that's another thing. It is great to have your friends over for brunch because you really can't, especially if you're not a very good cook. You know, you can just kind of get the pastry stuff. And
you make prune chicken for brunch?
No, I don't make prune chicken.
That's the only thing you know how to make.
Because it's my only meal that I cook. Actually, I've broadened my horizons.
What's your second dish?
Well, I've gotten pretty good at scallops, actually.
Oh, you have?
Yes, I have.
Put them in the broiler, take them out and eat them. Essentially. Those are really tough.
Mine are finely spiced, and they're dredged in things.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They are.
In prune chicken, they're dredged.
But anyway, you can have the nice breakfast things, and it's not that hard to do, and it doesn't cost you that much money either.
We have a chef on the phone. Oh, actually, we don't. We're going to get to him in a minute. My apologies.
Kim in Cambridge. Hi, Kim.
Hey, I just love your show. You guys are fantastic.
Well, thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
And my whole take on this, and I have lived all over the United States, and I totally love food, and I am a true believer that good food, any time of the day or night, is completely acceptable, whoever you are, wherever you are.
That's a pretty broad statement there, Kim.
It is. I mean, I sometimes I crave Vietnamese food at midnight, and I haven't found any around here, but the big city I'm from in the desert Southwest, you can go and get pho or any delicious food at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, if you want it, you should be able to have it. Brunch is just another way of local businesses to capitalize on time of day and whatever else people's vices are. If they're hungover, feed them. If you feed them, they will come.
You know,
that's
Kim, by the way, speaking of food being available all the time, I moved from illegal rent-controlled apartment to illegal rent-controlled apartment nonstop in New York. I once moved to Chelsea, and the only reason I moved to Chelsea in Manhattan, the only reason, it was a block away from the Empire Diner, which was open 24 hours a
Amen,
a
brother.
Day.
I'm with you on that.
Hey, Kim, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Chris in Wellfleet. You're a chef, Chris. You're the perfect person to talk to. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Well, yeah, I worked professionally as a chef for a bunch of years. I'm actually sort of retired right now, but I try to get
I try to do guest spots at some of the local restaurants when I can. But the point that I wanted to make about the brunch thing, from a professional perspective, most restaurant managements, most exec managers, most exec chefs will tell you that the Sunday brunch is great from an economic standpoint because it's traditionally the place where we figure out how to get rid of all the stuff that's in our walk-in.
Exactly. That's what the guy's saying. He says chefs bury the dregs of the week's dinners under rich sauces.
And you will never get, no matter what restaurant decides that they want to do a Sunday brunch, you will never get the best work from their kitchen staff during Sunday brunch.
It's beautiful.
This is the wholesale clearance time.
Well, that really, really makes me want to go, hey, Chris, thank you for the call. You know, we decided to go out to the street to talk to some real people about this, and we found this woman walking by. What's your name, please?
It's LaToya Edwards.
Oh, you're LaToya Edwards.
Oh, my gosh.
I've seen you on NECN. I love you, by the way.
We've seen her on TV a few times.
We're talking about brunch and whether brunch is for jerks. We know you're a big cruise person where they have brunch and things.
I can't stand you, Jim, for making fun of me about that.
Where are you on the brunch issue, LaToya Edwards? Are you pro-brunch or are you anti-brunch, please?
I'm pro-free food. I can't cook a lick, so if somebody's serving... No. My mom cooks every day, and she spoiled me, so my poor husband does everything. So if you're going to give me brunch, munch and crunch, I'll take it.
You don't care where it is or what it is.
It could be old food that you just took out of the bottom of your refrigerator. I'm eating it. Yes.
It's beautiful.
Now,
you're such a discriminating
LaToya Edwards,
person.
Famous anchorwoman from NECN, doing roaming the halls here at WGBH.
I was looking to rob Jim Browdy, actually, of his Whole Foods. No, actually, I was coming to see you, and I just thought I'd say hi and drop in. I also appeared on Basic Black.
So. Okay.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Let me just say one thing, because we only have a minute to go. One of the things we fight about most are not brunches. One of the things we fight about most are cruises. Is that correct?
You're so obnoxious, Jim, if I can say. Viewers, I love Jim
we
Browdy.
We call him these listeners. This is radio.
Oh, yeah,
thank
sorry.
You.
Whoopsie.
Hold on for a second. Yes. As long as LaToya's here.
Yeah.
I was at my book club the other night, it's a women's book club, and women come up to me, and they said, gee, I love you, no show. But they said to me, a line I bet you've heard many times, LaToya, how can you stand working with Jim Browdy?
I was out, and somebody said, I love your show, but is he really a jerk? And I said, yes.
It's really nice.
But he's a lovable jerk.
Lovable
you.
Jerk.
You know, he's so highfalutin. He always tears me down because I go on cruises. He's like, where
I love him.
They're the best.
You know where
they're
she went
easy?
For her last vacation?
Where'd she go?
Framingham. Or
Fitchburg.
No, Fitchburg. Excuse me.
Great Wolf Lodge.
Okay, fine.
Wonderful.
Goodbye.
Bye.
LaToya Edwards, watch
LaToya
her starting
Edwards.
At 4 today
and
on NECN.
And she's going to be on Basic Black tonight at 7:30, right after Emily Rooney's
Thank
Beat
you.
The Press, which is a great show. Thank you, LaToya Edwards. Up next, Facebook and Apple are trying to recruit more female employees by offering to pay for freezing and storing their eggs. Is this a great step for Silicon Valley? Just a crass message to women about what their priorities should be. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you and Babson College, committed to transforming the students of today into the entrepreneurial leaders of tomorrow with an MBA program in Boston and Wellesley. You can find more information online at babson.edu. And the Gershwins Porgy and Bess from San Francisco Opera. Lakeeta Bess and Eric Owen star in this critically acclaimed production of the Gershwins' masterpiece opera. Watch Porgy and Bess tonight at 9 on WGBH2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. More smart, local conversation is just ahead, right after an NPR news update. Thanks for taking us with you today. You're on 89.7 WGBH.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan kicks off Hour 2 with his take on Apple and Facebook's new perk, paying women employees to freeze their eggs. After Art, we'll get your take. Then our music trio, Edgar B. Herrick III, Brian McCreath, and Rob Hochschild, they join us with suggestions and sound from the best concerts heading into Boston.
Emily Rooney on hyperventilating Ebola coverage and a world-famous list of complaints and observations. Then our almost world-famous news quiz featuring two contestants from the Boston Circus Guild. The what? Stay tuned to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Hello, Jim.
This is hour two of what is now a three-hour show. Are you aware of
Thank
that?
Thank you. I keep forgetting that. This is hour two with Jim. Thank you very much for reminding me.
So how many likes is Facebook getting for their female-friendly policy that they'll pay for women employees to freeze their eggs? Apple's also offering egg freezing and storage. So maybe it's good for recruitment. But is this good for society and for the future generations who might not be pulled out of the freezer until mom and dad are in their 50s and ready to become parents for the first time? We'll get your thoughts on this in a minute. But first, joining us on the line is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center and the co-host of Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey, Art. Thanks for joining us on a Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me. I think most people listening to me would think this show was 7 or 8 hours.
No. So what do you think of this, Art?
Well, I have mixed views about it. On the one hand, there are plenty of employees working at those companies who would like the coverage. They've thought about egg freezing. The company didn't bring it up to them. They certainly have realized it's an option. It's a high-tech, highly literate, highly educated workforce. Prospective female employees probably fit the same profile. On the other hand, having the company say, you know, we'll help you freeze your eggs, why don't you stay at your desk from age 21 to age 40 and not worry about daycare and PTA meetings and any other little diversion that might take you away from the job. That could be interpreted as the company having a pretty big conflict of interest in touting egg freezing.
Yeah, I mean, it's borderline coercive. I mean, there is, to me, a pretty strong message along the lines of what you're saying. Plus, not to mention the fact, and I'm not suggesting women would not be aware of this, this is a pretty painful procedure. It's not like getting a flu shot.
Well, that's what bothers me a little bit about some of the coverage I've seen on this. Freezing eggs has only come into medicine as an accepted procedure, non-experimental, I don't think more than 2 or 3 years. So it's still relatively new. We haven't had a lot of kids made from frozen eggs, and that means the long-term health risks to the kids still not known. The numbers aren't that big, and we certainly haven't followed them for a couple of decades to see what might happen. When you get your eggs frozen, you have to take a lot of drugs to produce those eggs, so there are a lot of them there. That's risky for the woman. It's sometimes called superovulation. And while it's not horrendously risky, people do undergo it in normal in vitro fertilization, it's not risk-free. If you're going to use these techniques, listeners should understand it means in vitro fertilization. You freeze the egg, you fertilize it with sperm in a dish, and then you have to put it back in the woman's body. That means $10,000 a try. So this is that part of the procedure may not be covered. You could be working at Google now and find yourself 15 years later, and you don't have coverage for that kind of IVF procedure to finish it up. And as you said, either Marjorie or Jim, I forget who said it, but, you know, having kids into your 40s and 50s, that means a high-risk pregnancy. And probably a lot of burden socially in terms of older parents. The good news is you have more money. Bad news is I think you have less energy.
Well, you know what? Oh, yes. I think that's absolutely true. But one of the things I wonder, though, do we even know how often this works? I mean, if you do freeze your eggs for 15 years, what's the likelihood of you're getting pregnant from these frozen eggs? Is it any different?
This is a little tricky to answer. If you're healthy and you have normal eggs, and you freeze them, say, under the age of 35, you probably have a 30% chance of having a child. If you are, if it in fact hasn't been determined because you never knew that you had weak eggs or problems with your eggs, then this freezing is going to blind you to the fact, you won't discover it till later, that you have almost no chance of having a baby. So what I mean by that in English is, you may not realize you have infertility problems, and if you freeze bad eggs, you're going to have those same problems later, but there's going to be nothing to do about it then.
So can't you test the eggs before you freeze them, or is it just you're going blind? You can't,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you're really just
wow
going in blind. You're not. There's no real potency test. I know what you're asking. We don't have that.
Okay, so Art, before we let you go, I'm going to have you switch hats from medical ethicist to HR executive. This is allegedly part of the perks arms war in Silicon Valley. So women get this what's the comparable thing that men get? What do they get to go, be with Ted Williams at the cryogenic center out there in Arizona? What do men get?
Well, I don't know if they get to be with Ted Williams' head in the cryogenics lab. Maybe they get that week at the old geezer baseball camp to visit with their, you know, heroes of their youth. I don't think men are going to get anything, but you reminded me of something a little different. I wouldn't see this coverage going out beyond these boutique and very profitable companies, because it's one thing to say, I want to be reimbursed when I'm infertile. It's another thing to tell an insurance company, I want coverage because I choose to freeze my egg. Mm. They're going to see that as elective. They're going to see it as non-medical, as a kind of social choice. I don't think this is going to be something you can get unless you work at Google.
You know, that's a great point, too. Art Kaplan, that's why we love to talk to you. Thank you very much for taking the time on a Friday to be with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
We're going to call you on Saturday and Sunday to talk, too. Is that okay?
Right.
See you later, Art.
The meter's running, though. Watch out.
Okay. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Have a great weekend, Art. I would like to ask you guys what you think about this at 877-301-8970. Is this egg freezing business a bait and switch deal where it looks good on the surface? It seems like a very sympathetic gesture, but then once you're in it, you realize, oh, this means I can't get pregnant now. I have to freeze my eggs because you feel kind of coerced by your company and wait and deal with the pregnancy later when you're in your 40s or 50s. Or what if you don't want a kid? What do you get out of this? 877-301-8970. The idea that your company is covering this, that's kind of the – I mean, I suppose if you wanted to freeze your eggs because you're 30 and you're working around the clock and you haven't found Mr. Right and you don't want to take any chances, that's, I guess – I mean, that's fine, obviously, but to have a company say, oh, yeah, we're going to do this, makes you feel like you should do it, because as Art says, they want you to stay glued to your desk from age 21 to age 40 and work like a dog.
Let me use a word you often use to describe things, creepy. It is a creepy. Totally – I understand – by the way, I'm a huge believer in perks, and often perks matter more than salary does because they feel right. Even if they're not the same, this is actually quite expensive. But this is, to me, totally creepy. I think it absolutely sends the message that you were talking about and that Art was talking about. Here's another point of view. This is the Toronto's Global News. It's their morning show. They're talking about where the egg freezing deal, at least to them, so it's not just us you'll hear, is at least a little strange.
I don't know how I feel about companies going, please, ladies, give us all of your fertile years. And then we'll send you off at some point when you've done everything you need to do for us.
Mm-hmm. We'll give you a pink slip.
Baby. Yeah, we'll give you a pink slip in your eggs and then go ahead.
It sounds like, really? What are you going to do when you are ready for that time to have kids? Yeah. Are you going to support those women then? I'm not too sure about that because maybe, you know, having a kid at 45 is not the best thing for you. I'm just saying, I wish that they can support you when you're 25 as well.
Who supports this? I mean, obviously, these people are strategic enough. I assume they did survey groups or they hired some consultant. Who is the audience for whom there would be appeal? I understand if you're infertile or something.
A lot of these high-tech firms, they're overwhelmingly male, and I think that they're getting a lot of grief for that, and they want you to work, you know, 9,000 hours a week. I mean, they have Google. It's kind of this creepy little campus out there where they have dry cleaners and hairdressers. This is one in California, and hairdressers and barbers and daycare and everything else, so you can kind of stay there. And they even give you a bus back and forth to San Francisco. I'm reminded of a law firm in Boston about 10 years ago made a big deal about how they were going to open a daycare center on Saturday. Mm-hmm. It wasn't this wonderful that they were going to open a daycare center on Saturday. And I thought to myself, well, no, it's not wonderful, because what it's really doing is saying, now you can work 6 days a week, you know, 24 hours a day.
No, not you should work
exactly,
6 days a week.
Exactly. Right. So that's the part. And as Art Kaplan said, here's the other thing. If you're 25 and you freeze your eggs, wait to have your baby till you're 40 or 45, you may not get pregnant, and the eggs may not be good eggs. I didn't know they were good and bad eggs. I guess there are.
Other than that, we both think it's a really good idea. 877-301-8970. I want to get one more piece of sound in before we get to your calls. For those who are trying to be open-minded about this, here's where you will close your mind. If you weren't listening the other day, this is my, I think, my favorite sound of the week. This is this. It talks about what the culture is really like and what these guys who run these firms are like. Here's Microsoft CEO. This guy's name is Satya Nadella. He was speaking at some women's tech conference in Arizona. He was at, this is almost Saturday Night Live-esque. He was asked how women should go about asking for raises at these firms.
It's not really about asking for the raise, but knowing and having faith that the system will actually give you the right raises as you go along. And that, I think, might be one of the additional superpowers that, quite frankly, women who don't ask for a raise have. Because that's good karma. It'll come back.
You know, the sound, unfortunately, cut off prematurely because his next sentence was unbelievable. He says, women, forget the raise. Go freeze your eggs. 877-301-8970. You know, I've read about the culture a lot. We've talked about it a lot, including with Nancy Kane. And as you said, 70% plus of the people, particularly in important positions, are men. I cannot imagine what the culture is like from a gender perspective or anything else. Can you imagine an intelligent adult allowing these words to cross his lips?
No, but see, I think the thing is, that's one of the big things about Silicon Valley, isn't it? That there are all these boy geniuses working 24 hours a day, and they're sleeping at their desks and sleeping under their desks, whatever they're doing. Well, once you have a baby, you cannot work 20 hours a day. Somebody has to raise the children. If it's not going to be you, it's going to be your husband. Somebody's going to make that huge compromise because children, as we all know, are very time-consuming. You know?
Yeah, they tend to be,
and so for every moment you're taking care of your child and reading to your child and taking your kid to the park, you're not at your desk producing for Apple or Intel or the law firm that wants you to have on-site daycare.
So have faith that you'll get a raise. Don't ask for it, and freeze your eggs. That's the basic motto, apparently, of Silicon Valley. Let's take some calls. Gail, you're in Uxbridge. You're starting things off. Thanks so much for the call. Hi, Gail.
Hi, how are you?
We're excellent. Thank you.
I guess I see this as another example of what an unfamily-friendly culture we are, that they would, and misogynist, to boot, that I guarantee you if men were the people having babies, this would look a little different. Mm. And instead of offering good support services for people who choose to have children, they're offering for you to not have children. So that's my take.
Well, that is exactly what they're doing.
Because we don't have, for the most part, subsidized daycare. We don't have very good maternity leaves for women. A lot of the companies are not paid at all. You have unpaid maternity leave. And, of course, you can't afford to take much time off for maternity leave because if you could afford 6 months with no pay, you wouldn't be working kind of deal.
If you look at other cultures, other countries, they offer services that are really much more supportive of families. And when we talk about children being the future, which we give a lot of lip service to, we just don't do a whole lot that sort of backs that up.
Did you ever see, even though a lot of people have a real hard time with it, did you ever see Sicko, Michael Moore's film about the healthcare systems?
I love Michael Moore.
There is a scene, and I forget if it's France or Germany, where it's some place in Western Europe, where not only do women get paid maternity leave, men get paid paternity leave, and the government, and it is much more of a social democracy kind of thing, the government sends workers to your house to help train you about how to have a healthy child, how to take care of the child. I mean, it's a different universe. Gail, thank you for a fine call. We appreciate it.
All right.
Sheila's emailing in saying that we should Apple should also help finance adoptions of covering or promoting fertility, refreezing eggs, which is a good point too. I mean, if they should be covering a lot of options if they're going to do that. But you know what the other thing is before we get back to the calls?
Yeah.
I think one of the hard things for young women today is that they feel they need to be really established in their career before they can jump off the fast lane to have children. And so you start to get nervous, people have difficulty getting pregnant. I mean, there's infertility rampant all through the culture. So you get nervous when you're like 35, 36, 37. Am I even going to be able to have a baby? So this is why it's a good option to have. I mean, I like the fact that you had that your company paying for that, except the other side of it is so creepy. You know what I mean?
Well, also, by the way, just so you know, if you're not a faithful listener of the show, we take all calls in order. We're not screening out calls that disagree with us. Unfortunately, lines are full with people who do. But so let me just say, it's almost impossible if someone were to call and say, I like the benefit.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible, even if you like the benefit, to suggest that there's not another much more important agenda, the one you and Art Kaplan mentioned.
Right.
The basic message that is that not that subliminal is don't have a kid until you've put in 20 or 25 years of working, you know, slave-like here 24-7, you're not going to get anywhere. Then if you want to have your kid, as those people in Toronto said, you know, when you give you your pink slip, then go to it. I mean, it's obscene. It's just, and by the way, are they providing childcare? You mentioned this before. I mean, let's assume a family wants to have a kid, not at 25, but at, you know, not at 45, but at 25. Are they providing as much of a benefit for those people?
I don't know how much they give you for babies, but they it says some of these high-tech companies offer generous paid parental leave to both men and women, and they offer baby cash payments of $500 to $4,000. Google and Intel are among the few to offer not just ping-pong tables and dry cleaning, but on-site child care, and some of them do embrace flexible work arrangements. So I don't know how much the on-site childcare costs.
You know what
costs.
The on-site childcare is? It's a drawer in your desk. That's what.
But as most people with young children in daycare know, daycare is almost as expensive as your mortgage, you know, for when your kids are little, and nannies aren't cheap either. So it's really difficult for women to be working a lot of hours when their children are small, or I should say women and men, because they both are supposed to be raising the kids. Anyway, Jennifer from Ashland. What do you think, Jennifer?
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I am a mom who went through IVF, so I can speak to the whole process of what a person would go through mm-hmm. if they were having their eggs frozen, and it's definitely not easy. And also, the other point I was calling to make is that I think maybe we should stop talking about freezing eggs and just have a family if you want one.
Well, Jennifer, IVF is covered by insurance in Massachusetts, right?
Yes, it is.
Which and that's unusual.
Not to be, yes, it is.
Yeah, so if you had
how
to pay...
It is unusual?
I believe it's very unusual that if very you had good. To pay out of pocket, that's about $10,000 a shot.
It's probably a lot more than that.
Is it a lot more than that?
Well,
okay.
Because often you have to do another round, which is
no,
another
$10,000. No, I'm saying per time. So you're saying it may be even more than $10,000. So unless you have enormous resources, thank goodness Massachusetts does. Well, that's one of the reasons why Massachusetts has highest, I think, in the country.
Does
not Jennifer?
Costs?
No, of twins and triplets.
Oh, yes. Is that true? We do?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because
much higher chance of having multiples with IVF because they put they implant more than one egg at a time.
No, that part I knew. What I didn't know is that where Massachusetts ranked in terms of...
Because we cover in vitro fertilization, and I'm glad
right.
we do. Jennifer, thank you very much for the call.
I was about to say doublets instead of twins. You know how the word wouldn't come because you said triplets?
Yeah.
And then...
No, it's very common in Massachusetts. Phil from Plymouth, what do you think, Phil?
Hey, Phil.
Present's bad, future's worse. I can see where they're going. My daughter goes to a VOTAC in the child care. They actually have high-tech robotic infants that can sense when they're moved, fed, changed. So what we're looking at is high-tech robotic children, and then Facebook, Google has the driverless car. Google will make the parentless infant robot, and then Facebook will provide the avatar. Horrible idea. Sends a lousy message. And I wish you a great, great day and great show.
Same to you, Phil.
Thank
that
you very
great,
much.
That was
yeah,
a great call.
Well, that is what's coming, right? We're talking about the robots taking over all the time. In the old folks' home, right? The robots are going to be there.
As company, yeah.
As company.
But by the way, there are pieces of that.
Talk
I mean, it's
to the robot.
But
sing to the robot.
Yeah, but it's better than nothing. I mean, a human is preferable. I'm not saying it isn't. But a lot of people end up. Whatever.
Oh God!
It can
let's
do some tests.
Come to that.
The reason we're talking about
over.
This, if you just tuned in, is because Facebook and Apple apparently are making history, where they have just announced that they are providing a new perk to their female employees, Silicon Valley, etc. To help recruit more female employees, I guess, or to keep them, they will pay for freezing and storing. I almost can't get through the sentence. Freezing and storing. Their eggs. They see it as a perk, as a benefit that a lot of women would like, and critics have suggested that it's really a not-so-subtle message to suggest you should not have kids now. You should work to the bone. And then when you're in your 40s, maybe you can defrost those babies and take it from there.
Michael from Framingham. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, good day.
Hi.
So as a perk from a company to help draw employees, I think it's great. TJX Companies in Framingham, I was an outside contractor, and I noticed 10 years ago they had an on-site daycare for their employees.
Mm.
But as far as, you know, expecting it as a mandated thing for going forward, everybody, I don't think that's going to be good to keep costs down. And then my other perspective on this is, okay, so the women get this benefit. That's great. So what do the men get?
Well, that was Jim's first question immediately. What do the men get?
But at the end of the day, you know, this is in the high cost of living today, for a corporation that can do it, that can say, you know, we can freeze your eggs so that you can have kids later so we can keep you working, or we have an on-site daycare facility so you bring your kids here instead of spending $3,000 a month to store to have your children somewhere else. It's I think, what all American business is all about.
Well, the goal, you're right. I mean, you're describing a family-friendly environment, and that's the goal. And the question is, this add to that, or is this just a creepy attempt to suggest that you're family-friendly? Michael, thanks for the call. By the way, somebody who deserves, I hate the term shout-out, I don't know why I was about to say this. Do you know where the first, to my understanding, corporate on-site childcare place was in America, the very enlightened corporate executive?
Oh, I think it's Hyatt. Is it
Stride? Arnold Hyatt, who founded Stride, who, by the way, is the brother of the late wife of Bob Kraft, Myra Kraft, very principled co-owner of the New England Patriots, obviously, who's since died. Arnold Hyatt started this thing at Stride Right a couple of decades
ago. It's great to have on-site daycare, especially when you're there with your first child and you're a nervous wreck and the baby's an infant and you can run down during a coffee break and make sure that, you know, everything is A-OK. It's great. And I think it's great that they're offering these benefits. Don't get me wrong. What I think is bad is if you feel as though there's pressure on you. That's the problem.
Well,
right?
How can you not? I mean, how can you not? I mean, well, they're doing this out of, if they really care
because
about.
Because I do think there's a lot of very young, ambitious women that are not even thinking about,
well, you know what you do
getting
then?
Married or having children.
Fine. Then you put $20,000 in a flexible account or something for which you could take that money to spend it on a variety of things. One of them being this, freezing and storing eggs if you choose. And if you're not, you could spend it on childcare or whatever it is. They've chosen this because it sends the message they want. Scent. Is that, I mean, it's so obvious to me. In any case, let's go to, I hope your name is Rafa. I hope I got that right. And you're calling from Philly, my hometown. Hey there, Rafa.
Hey, it's actually Raffy.
But Raffy, sorry. Hi.
Oh my goodness, like the singer.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway,
what's going on?
So I do academic research on implicit gender bias in businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting things I find about this particular egg freezing thing is that while freezing your eggs is fantastic, like, I think it's really expensive, so it's interesting that they offer it. But a lot of them offer products and things for families that would actually help them that are not as highlighted. And if they highlighted those, then maybe they would actually be successful in recruiting these women. So
like what? Like, for example?
So, for example, things like a lot of them do offer paid parental leave, and a lot of them do have on-site childcare services, or they help them with childcare issues in some way or another, or they offer the ability to telecommute a lot of the time, or they offer more flexible work hours and things like that. If they don't offer them, then that's what they should probably be doing with that money, and it would arguably cost them less. But highlighting those aspects would, as the research shows, actually help them with their goal of recruiting more women to those jobs.
Well, the flexible hour thing you talked about, of which I am a huge, flex time or compressed hours, whatever it is a huge draw, not just, by the way, for women, but for men, as you probably know far better than I. So
Raffy, yeah, he is right. And these stories that we read this morning do say that some of these companies do offer those kinds of things. They're not just offering frozen eggs and nothing else, Jim.
Raffy, thanks for the contribution.
Kind of
we appreciate it.
Smorgasbord of options that you get. I don't know anybody personally that works at one of those companies.
Our number is 877-301. We're talking about the frozen egg program at Facebook and Apple that's been announced. They will pay for freezing and storage. It's a perk. I don't mean a perk in a pejorative way. Perk is it's a extra benefit you get as a worker at these companies. Theoretically, it's because it accommodates a need that, at least to the two of us, is somewhat debatable.
Do you know what you notice? And I'm sure you notice this in Cambridge, too.
What's that?
And I noticed it in Brookline, which is an expensive place to live, and so is Cambridge. How many mothers are older? You know, you go to the playground and you see women that are in their, well into their 40s, and they've got little babies with them. And it's just, it, you know, it's just such a a different thing than certainly our parents' generation. Anyway, Susan from Boston. Hi, Susan.
Hello, Susan.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Love the show.
Thank you.
I fall on the side of, why is my employer's big nose in my personal business?
That's a good point.
I don't want them having knowledge of my personal life, and if there's going to be a benefit, let it be cash only, you know, financial only. Why is health insurance even connected to my employer? It's kind of the other side of the Hobby Lobby coin, where they wouldn't pay, they didn't want to have health coverage for people who wanted birth control. How should they know if people are on birth control or wanting to freeze their eggs? It's none of their business.
You know, by the way, that's part of the motivation, not the primary piece of the motivation, for those who say America should move away from an employer-based healthcare system
to
single-payer, not just because of the efficiencies and the cost controls, or I mean the lower, but also because, you're right, the privacy issues, which theoretically are attended to. But I tend to agree with you, probably honored in the breach.
But that's a great point, Susan, which I had never thought of. I assumed, and maybe I'm crazy, that my employer had no idea what I'm doing.
Well,
with
I think in theory
insurance.
You don't. I don't know for a fact that they do. But there is, I mean, use your word again, there's a creepiness factor that I think is troubling.
The connection is just too creepy and too suspect. I would not trust that they did not know what was going on. And anyway, if they're offering this as a benefit, they're expecting women to take advantage of it. How will it happen if they don't know? How will it happen without their knowledge?
Yeah, I assume their position would be, hey, Susan, the NSA knows. Why shouldn't we? I think that's where they – Susan, thank you. It's an excellent point.
Yeah, there are an awful lot of people sneaking off to rehab that hope their bosses don't find out about it.
Well, by the way, there are a lot of people – and again, I don't understand what the reality is. I know what on paper the divide is supposed to be, and they're not supposed to know. A lot of people are concerned – a word I occasionally anger listeners with – who go to shrinks. Are concerned, I don't want my employer to know that I'm seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a therapist. And a lot of people worry, hopefully it's not well-founded, that the employer is going to find out. Now, of course, there shouldn't be a stigma attached to it, but a lot of people worry
because
the stigma is not gone.
When you're signing those 17 HIPAA forms when you go to the doctor's office, I assume that is about maintaining your privacy. Is your company calling up and saying, what was Jim Browdy the doctor
for? I don't think the insurance company would provide the information. It just, you know, in an era, I mean – on paper, I think you're totally right. I am with Susan, though. It is very hard to believe in this environment in 2014, after we lived through Edward Snowden, that companies who want to cross that line are not able to do it. Maybe I'm wrong, and if I am, I assume someone will call and disabuse me of the notion.
Susan from Framingham, what do you think, Susan?
You notice everybody on the line is Susan, but literally every single person. Susan,
yeah,
hi.
Well, it was the most popular name for girls in late 50s, early 60s.
Well, here it is. Welcome, Susan.
For one thing, just in response to you, do your employers know? You're darn right they know. I was in a bad car accident working for a large car law firm and was told that I was raising their premiums. So they know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, in all fairness, like in that situation, though, Susan, and I'm surely not defending them, it's pretty obvious if you're in a car accident that you're getting health care. So they do know. I'm not defending their actions or their words. But in that case, it's a little more obvious. But go ahead, Susan.
Yeah. So, this just goes to the whole point of, who gets benefits and for what. The question's about, well, what do men get? Last time I checked, they're the other half of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
If they get child care, they're getting the child care as well. But my point is, what about people who don't want children, who don't have families by choice and, they're not getting the same amount of benefits, even if they're working just as hard.
Well, Susan, but
sometimes harder.
I do mean to interrupt you just to say, but that argument also carries. Young employees often say, I'm working next to a person who's 50, next to another person who's 70, I'm 22. I'm going to use health care much less than he or she is. So they're getting a much more serious benefit. Give me the cash. Which is one of the reasons why. What's that?
The distinction in that case is, barring a death, all of us are going to be in the position of
eventually. That's true.
Of eventually doing that.
You're right. You're right.
And if you're getting the health care from your employer, providing it's a large enough employer, then
the cost of that is spread out.
Well, it's sort of like the Affordable Care Act. That's the reason why the president wanted so many young people to sign up so they could. Susan, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay,
aren't we supposed to say we attempted to have the presidents of Apple and Facebook join us, but they were unavailable
at
this time?
We did not make that attempt,
Jim. No, we did not. We should have, but we didn't.
Okay. Up next, it is time for our concert roundtable, a preview of upcoming performances, jazz, classical, alternative music lovers. We have got you covered with sound and fun. Next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio and one of our favorite segments. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for our monthly concert roundtable are Rob Hochschild. He's the Director of Communications at Berklee College of Music. Hey there, Rob.
Hi, everyone.
Brian McCreath is the host with 99.5 WCRB and producer of the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast. And Marjorie and I are going in mid-November, Brian.
I know.
As you know,
excited.
We're very excited.
Looking forward to that.
And Edgar B. Herrick III, the man behind WGBH's Curiosity Desk. Hello, Edgar.
Hello, hello.
And to you. So where do we start?
Yeah, who's going to start?
Let's stop.
These
guys both have four picks. I only have three. So
okay,
let's
so we'll start. We'll right, start with you, Edgar.
Fair enough.
Then.
Fair enough. All right. So the theme today for my concert picks is a journey through the decades. We're going to have an artist from the 70s, from the 80s, from the 90s, and from the 2000s.
Ooh, I like that.
So I think we'll start in the 70s.
Okay.
We're going to go back to the 70s. While this guy's still operating now, probably had his peak in the 70s in terms of being a singer-songwriter, and this is the vaunted artist Randy Newman.
Oh gosh.
Total genius.
How good
wow.
is this guy, right?
Oh my God.
So,
so funny.
Yeah, I mean, what's really interesting about Randy Newman is I think he's probably more known to people now than they realize. He's recently done the music for a ton of these Disney Pixar movies, right? Cars and Toy Story, Monsters, Inc. He's also written some 25, 30 film scores, right? So he's been – and he has the interesting distinction of being the person who had the most Academy Award nominations before ever winning.
I actually knew that. That's
15
right.
15 times wow. he was nominated for Academy Awards for his music before he ever won. And he did, you know, not only just
music.
What
did he win for? What did he win for?
He won for one of his songs
Disney
for
thing.
Monster, Inc.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's the first time. But he also does scores in addition to songs, right? So he did the score for Awakenings, The Natural, Seabiscuit. Mm. So,
really?
Yeah. Totally. But on it.
Not just
absolutely.
Really, but totally.
He did the total score, the beginning and the end, yeah. But, you know, his roots are in the 70s as a singer-songwriter, first as a writer of music for all kinds of artists, and then in his own right. So I want to go back and listen to one of his tunes from the 70s just to remind people who Randy Newman is and what he sounds like. This is one of my favorite Randy Newman songs, Lonely at the Top.
I've been around the world, had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name.
You know one of the things I love about Randy Newman? He looks exactly like he sounds.
Yes,
does
exactly.
He not?
Exactly. Grumpy, disheveled, gray-haired, big glasses, you know what I mean?
When's he coming to town?
He's coming to town November 19th. He's playing at the Wilbur. I think that's going to be a great show. He's like famous, you know, in concert for sometimes being very rumpled and grumpy, but he always performs really well. Another interesting thing about him, do you know who he cites as his single most important influence?
No.
Ray Charles.
Wow.
Really?
And you can hear it in the way he sings. You can hear that sort of affect where you get that sense of Ray Charles was huge for him. But, he is the quintessential American songwriter.
Can I just jump in here? Because there's actually a deeper root to Randy Newman than what you mentioned. You
what
talk
is
about his roots in the 70s and with Ray Charles.
Sure.
But Randy Newman comes from a Hollywood dynasty.
Yeah.
So
he
Alfred,
does?
Alfred Newman and Emil Newman.
Oh, from Mad Magazine, sure.
These were film composers of the early decades of sound movies, and their family has continued along in this vein. I talked to Randy Newman's cousin, David Newman, when he was here in Boston to conduct the BSO in West Side Story. And
wow.
And so this is a family that grew up in one of the most exciting, vibrant places you could possibly be in for music, and that's why he soaks in Ray Charles and film music. It all comes in because in Los Angeles, if you're working in the movie business, you do soak in everything, and then if you're good, you get that back out into movies or on the stage. Like
so, Brian McGree, since you butted in right in the middle of Edgar B. Hurwitz, why don't you give us your first selection?
I know. So my theme is a journey through the centuries.
Ooh. Yeah, that's it.
Very good.
Sorry, that's just
I'm doing decades.
I'm doing decades, and of course, McGree comes into one up with, I'm doing centuries.
I'll get to millennia next time. Okay, so I am very excited because it's not, you know, I feel like a bit of a one-trick pony. I come in here and talk about how great the BSO is a lot because it is a world-class orchestra, one of many world-class organizations in Boston. But I am extremely excited that in the next few weeks, two other world-class orchestras are going to be visiting Symphony Hall, and they're two of my favorite orchestras. The Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra will be coming in on, let's see, that's November 7th. And then just 9 days later, the San Francisco Symphony is going to be visiting Symphony Hall. What I love about these two programs is that they both reflect the roots of these orchestras. So the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, literally the oldest continually operating orchestra in the world.
This is wow.
Since the days of about 1730, that's how they trace their roots back to what's called the Collegium Musicum, which Bach ran. Okay? So this organization comes directly out of those roots. And
Edgar,
still
eat
operating.
Your heart out,
I'm sitting
baby.
Here. I'm, thinking, you know, I'm like, well, Newman really started in the 60s. I mean, he was known in the 70s, but he started in the 60s.
Sorry,
wait a minute,
Brian.
Were all the modern instruments that are in a symphony
They have survived as an organization, thrived as an organization through the evolution of the orchestra itself. And one of their conductors during the 1830s, I believe it was, could be 1820s, was Felix Mendelssohn, one of the great composers.
Oh,
they will be playing music by Mendelssohn at Symphony Hall, the Reformation Symphony and the Hebrides Overture. So I'm extremely excited just to hear them do music of their own place. But I'm also excited because just whether you knew anything about their history or not, their sound is so unique. So let's just listen to a little bit. This is Brahms, which is their most recent recording. Let's just listen to a little bit of the Brahms Symphony No. 4. If we were going to A, B recordings, which probably don't have time for right now, we would hear in other orchestras, maybe even the BSO, a little bit more of a lush sound, a little bit more of a thick texture. In the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, there's a transparency that I've never heard in any other orchestra. I've heard them in Leipzig, I've heard them in Symphony Hall before, and I love the way this orchestra plays.
When you say transparency, what do you mean?
I mean that you can see straight through all the lines that are coming off the stage. You can see through them in a way that is different from the kind of blend that the Boston Symphony gets. The Boston Symphony has a beautiful, beautiful blend, but it's like you're tasting wine. Sorry to get extra snobby on you, but it's like you're tasting wine, and some wines come at you as a full force blend, and other wines you just separate those flavors instantly, and that's how Leipzig is.
Now, hold on for 1 second. Yeah. What instruments were not here in 1730?
You're going back to this.
Was the piano?
Okay, so
here?
Trumpets didn't have valves.
Really?
Trombones weren't even actually used in orchestras until Beethoven.
And what about the piano?
The piano was not even the piano in 1730s.
Still the harpsichord.
It was still the harpsichord. Yeah. Just now getting into the forte piano, which was an early version of what we now know as the piano. Okay. So,
by the way, have you ever seen anybody dance to Brahms before Marjorie just did? I'm serious.
Actually,
this is all you have?
No, Brahms is filled with dancing. Fine. It is just brilliant music. So I love that about the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. And then when San Francisco comes in, they're actually reflecting their own hometown as well because they have music by a composer named Samuel Carl Adams, who has written a piece that he's a composer about 28, 29 years old right now, living in San Francisco, and they're bringing along one of his pieces because Michael Tilson Thomas is someone who has done his best to reflect the culture of the West Coast. And this is what they're going to be reflecting in the concert they'll play at Symphony Hall. So that's on November 16th and Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra on the 7th.
So it's our monthly concert roundtable. Who would be next, Marjorie?
Rob Hochschild from Berkeley would be next with a little bit of jazz. Please tell us about it.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I have no theme here. I'm sorry to report.
It's okay.
So I'm going to do my best. I'm going to say one word right now that you don't normally hear from the jazz guy, and that word
is Beyonce.
Oh,
so now the reason why
we call her BK, by the way. But go ahead.
Okay, all right. Good to know. Well, the artist that I'm going to tell you about is named Tia Fuller, and she's an alto saxophonist and soprano player and a flute player, and she toured with Beyonce for years. So she provided these moments in the middle of Beyonce concerts, which I have to admit I have not yet been to one. Perhaps one of you have, but there is a moment when a saxophonist stands and plays this incredible interlude, and it's been a big moment in a lot of Beyonce shows for years. So... But this was a jazz saxophonist who, like, born and bred and in the New York scene. She's from Colorado, now teaches at Berkeley. But she's a band leader and a composer and an amazing saxophonist. And she's actually learned a lot about being a jazz player from her Beyonce experience. And that is, like, how to really connect with an audience. One problem a lot of jazz musicians have, I suppose, in a way, is that their music is sort of delivered from on high and it's hard to sort of comprehend. So some people say, I don't necessarily feel that way. But this is somebody who really learned through these Beyonce experiences how to really connect with an audience, and also what the importance of freedom in jazz is. So let's listen to a little bit of Tia Fuller. It's a tune called Angelic Warrior. Hard to imagine that being played at a Beyonce concert.
It is hard to imagine. You know, how unusual are female saxophone, alto saxophone players?
Less and less unusual all the time. You know, I think 20, 30, in Randy Newman's 70s or 60s, it was probably
yeah.
very unusual. You know, these days it's happening a lot more, and artists like Tia Fuller are demand to be taken seriously, you know, and there has been a long-term sort of chauvinism in jazz music, I think, and I think that's really changing. And there's, you know, you got Esperanza Spalding, and you've got Tia, Terry Lynn Carrington as a drummer on this track.
And Grace Kelly.
And Grace Kelly's another one.
Local kid for Brookline, yes?
Exactly.
No?
Yes.
When did the saxophone enter the orchestra?
It was Adolph saxophone.
Okay, this is coming along much later than
1800s.
You notice how competitive this has grown over the months we've been doing this, gentlemen. It's a whole different experience.
It's a smackdown.
Yeah.
Rob, thank you. We're back to you, Edgar, for round two. What decade are we coming
to? We're going
from?
To the 80s.
80s, perfect.
Let's go to the 80s, and one of my favorite bands from the 80s, The Pretenders. Let's hear a little.
I found a picture of you. Oh,
oh, oh. Oh my
God. What hijacked my world at
time
night.
Travel.
Yep.
One of my all-time favorite songs.
I mean, this song is so good. 1982. The Pretenders, of course, is essentially Chrissie Hynde. She's the voice you're hearing here, and for my money, you can't get a better female vocalist than Chrissie Hynde in like rock music. What I think is really interesting about her is that, you know, she was American-born, and then she went to London and was really like caught up in the early punk scene in London. And she's one of these artists, and there's a few of them in the 80s, but I think the Pretenders are a really good example of this, is that I think that the punk scene, both in America and in London in the 70s and 80s, it was high on spirit, and I really love the spirit of punk music, but maybe their musical chops didn't always match the spirit and the energy of the music, and that's part of the charm of punk music, but there were a handful of bands. I think of the Talking Heads as one here in America that sort of grow out of the punk movement but have these musical chops that are maybe a little bit more digestible, and did a good job through the 80s of like making really interesting music that has the spirit of punk but has sort of a different thing going on. So she's coming to town. Interestingly enough, The Pretenders, which was a rotating cast of musicians over the course of years, she always recorded under the name The Pretenders, but it was essentially her. She recently released her first solo album under the name Chrissie Hynde. So she's going to be playing on November 1st at the Orpheum. She's going to be playing the music of The Pretenders and music from her new record. And like I said, I mean, I would go on a date with Chrissie Hynde now in a second if I could. I mean, I could listen to her sing all day.
You know, you mentioned the Talking Heads a minute ago, and I'm always looking for great concert movies. What's the name of the great Talking Heads concert?
Stop Making Sense.
Isn't that one of the great? Absolutely
one of the greatest.
Is David Byrne still around performing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, he got really interested in like, you know, the Brazilian music of the 60s and 70s and like South American music. I mean, he really explored into the world music place, and then he also still pushes into like electronica, and I mean, he's doing interesting stuff still.
That's great.
Yeah.
Chrissy Hines' voice is still really good then.
You know what? It's really interesting. I was reading a review of her solo record, which I listened through, and it's good. The songs are good. But one of the things one of these reviewers said, which I think was spot on, is that the producer did a very smart thing, and he kept her voice really high in the mix, recognizing that the thing that makes her great is her voice, and her voice still sounds unbelievable.
I love that.
You're talking about the punk bands that kind of didn't have a lot of musical chops and had all the energy.
Yeah.
There's a lot about technique that preserves your voice. David Byrne is someone who has great singing technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His voice sounds great. Chrissy Hynde just knows how to sing.
Totally.
So that voice is preserved over however many years.
Okay. You know, interject something here, and you're all going to cringe when I say this, but I'll say it anyway.
It's good intro, Marjorie. Go ahead.
Well, we did a thing about Barbra Streisand being on with
Jimmy Fallon.
Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, yeah.
Barbra Streisand is going to be 70 years old.
She is 70, I think.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't know if anybody's going to cringe, but she sounded
brilliant.
Unbelievable.
When he would allow her to sing.
Yeah, he kind of sang over her all the time, but I thought, wow. Yeah. Because that's unusual, is it not, to be able to sing at that age?
I think to Brian's point, it really depends on your technique and how well you're taking care of your instrument through the years. I think you see some people whose voice gets destroyed over time. You know, Bob Dylan or Tom Waits.
Joni Mitchell's voice.
Joni Mitchell.
She smoked.
That was.
And so did Frank Sinatra smoke.
So
I wondered if it was the smoking or the aging.
Oh, you know that.
If you don't smoke. And you don't smoke too much weed, maybe when you're 70.
Yeah, who knows? Interesting thing about Chrissy Hynde, she had a daughter with Ray Davies from the Kinks, mm-hmm. right? They have a daughter. I just recently saw that their daughter was protesting fracking in London, right? And so some people chain themselves to something or whatever. She and the guy that she was with super glued themselves together. this is not a joke. They literally super glued themselves together in front of
fracking
area.
So why would the cops want to stop that? Who cares? Let them stop.
I don't know.
That is pretty good.
Super
it hurts,
glued.
Though.
Amazing.
Okay, Brian McCreath, round two for you, my friend.
Well, I mentioned centuries before, so actually let's just deal with that concept. Let's go ahead and listen to some music here that's sung by Blue Heron.
It's coming.
It's coming.
Talk about technique.
I was going to say, you have to take care of your voice in a different way.
Jeez.
So we've talked about Blue Heron on this program
this is
before.
Unbelievable.
I'm going beautiful. This weekend.
They are a world-class Renaissance choir, right?
Ah.
Here's what's really fun. They've got a special event coming up, and it's on November 15th. It's called Capturing Music. They've decided to team up with a friend of mine teaches at Harvard named Thomas Forrest Kelly. He's a musicologist, but he writes books that are just absolutely brilliant about music history. The biggest splash he made was with a book he wrote called First Nights, which tells the story literally of five world premieres that changed the world. That's fun. But his new book is literally about how people started writing down music. It's about the language of music. And so it's a multimedia presentation where Blue Heron will sing music. This is from the 12th century. This is from a composer, the first one who ever thought that you could have two different lines going on at the same time, a composer named Leo Nan. And so Blue Heron will be along with Thomas Forrest Kelly to demonstrate a lot of this ancient music and how it is that before any recordings existed, before anyone could do anything other than oral tradition, how music was able to be preserved, passed along, and performed in countless places because then people could read music.
You know, Marjorie and I are preparing this weekend for our Tuesday night gubernatorial debate, and Marjorie yeah. sheepishly says to me this morning, I can meet any time this weekend, except when did you say?
8 o'clock Saturday night.
And she says, you're not going to like why it is that I can't meet. Why can't you meet Saturday night?
Because I'm going to go see them perform.
That's
nice.
Great.
I love that sort of medieval Renaissance.
It's entrancing. And so there's never a reason not to go to a Blue Heron concert. But I think in this case, there's this extra multimedia kind of intellectual fascination with what Tom Kelly's going to talk about in terms of what the language of music actually is. It's gonna be a
so
lot of fun.
We're down to two for each of our participants because you came one short today, Rob. So you know what we'll do?
It's okay.
We'll take a break. When we come back, round three, well, sort of two and a half for Rob. Round three of our concert roundtable. Don't go away.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you are just tuning in, we were reviewing concerts in the area covering all genres of music, classical, jazz, alternative. We're joined by Rob Hochschild, Director of Communications at Berklee College of Music, Brian McCreath, who's down the hall with 99.5 WCRB and a producer for the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast, and Edgar B. Herwig III, who sits next to me, who's with WGBH's Curiosity Desk. Thank you all for coming in. I forget whose tune.
It's Rob.
I think we're over to Rob.
Okay, over to Rob.
Hello.
Okay, Rob, thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you, Marjorie.
You're welcome.
I neglected to mention when I was talking during the first set about Tia Fuller. I didn't say where when she was playing. She's playing November 5th at Scullers. Great place to see a show. So that's Tia Fuller.
And by the way, we post all this on our website after the show. So for those who are driving or worried they missed something, all of the performances, the dates, the times will be posted. I'm sorry, Rob. Cool.
So I'll start with the date and time of this one. It's tomorrow night at Northeastern University's Blackman Auditorium. It's the John Coltrane Memorial Concert, and this is a big annual show for Northeastern, and Berklee gets involved with it too, and musicians from all over the country get involved in it, and every year they pay homage to one of the greatest jazz artists ever, musicians of the 20th century, really great composer, saxophone player, and what their theme, they have a theme on their concert this year, it's A Love Supreme, which is, this is the 50th anniversary of A Love Supreme, which was John Coltrane's quintessential, like, spiritual jazz album of, it came out in 64, his classic quartet played on it, and this was really his attempt to, you know, speak his gratitude and quest for purity, and it's really a beautiful album in four movements. So they're going to do this ensemble of Boston-based musicians and one guest artist, Donald Harrison. And so what we're going to listen to right now is a piece of another John Coltrane Memorial Concert, and it's a Coltrane composition that's actually not on Love Supreme, but it gets at what he's doing in that album. It's called Dear Lord. So if we had, like, 8 minutes. Yeah, I know. It's very relaxing.
Just breathing with this.
Yeah, it just draws you right in. You're just, like, laying inside of it, just covered in it.
Oh, yeah. It's a big jazzy blanket, yes.
What's
sorry.
What's his name again?
John Coltrane?
No, the guy who's playing right
okay,
now.
Okay, that saxophonist is Bill Pierce.
Okay.
And that was the 2009 concert. Unfortunately, Bill Pierce is not on the bill for this concert. There are other great saxophonists like Carl Atkins, Leonard Brown, and Donald Harrison's the big guest artist. Bill Pierce is over at Berklee, and he really embodies that Coltrane sound in a great way.
This
is just beautiful. And you can, it's great that it's still going in the background. This just keeps going, and it intensifies and it deepens. And I really think this is a special concert. I've been to it a bunch of times. And you really get immersed in one artist's sort of compositional path and his message. And it's really, I really recommend this one a lot tomorrow night.
You know, beyond the you know, sort of theme of A Love Supreme, which is, you know, a big thing, and it's part of why the album's so great. Like, from a musical standpoint, what is it that makes that album so special?
Oh, man. Well, it's sort of like what we heard a little bit of in the beginning of this tune. It's like a classical composition in a way.
It's much more organized than a lot of sort of typical jazz tunes that you normally would have, which is chorus, improvisation, or whatever. There's a lot more structure to this.
It's a four part arrangement. It's about a 35 or 40 minute long album, and each segment of it sort of refers back to something earlier. There's an improvisational part of everyone, and I think it just sort of hangs as a full statement. Harmonically, I think there's a lot of modal structure in the composition, but I'm not really positive about it. It certainly feels that way because of that floating feeling in a lot of his work of the mid-60s and early 60s was modal, and that's why it kind of feels that way. So, and also just the sound of John Coltrane that Bill Pierce just embodied so well. It's big and it's beautiful.
And you're listening to our monthly concert roundtable.
Monthly.
Brian McCreath, I'm sorry.
Concert
what are you saying?
Table.
Thank you,
Mark. I just wanted to jump in and say that Eric Jackson will be there.
Eric Jackson, that's
from
right.
89.7.
Oh, Eric Jackson. Who's got one of the great voices of all time.
Not to mention unbelievable knowledge and feel for jazz.
But just to hear him talk.
Yeah.
Okay, so Edgar, all three of you guys, we got to pick up the pace to drop because we want to get as much in as we possibly can. All Edgar, right. Take it away.
Let's do it. I'm just going to set up my tune and then have our producers play the John Coltrane again instead. So you got that in the control room? No. So we're moving on to the 90s and a band called the Jayhawks, who are one of these bands that they actually got started in the mid-80s in Minneapolis. They've been making music ever since then. Never to great success. They never really had anything that charted big time. But they were part of a movement in the sort of late 80s and into the early and mid 90s that was pretty popular in Minneapolis, which was sort of this alt-country thing where they were kind of going back to roots music and really interested in sort of more early American music, early country music, but not country music, big, glossy sort of pop country music that you hear, but the simpler kind of instruments, acoustic country roots kind of thing. And what's interesting in the scene in Minneapolis is that these bands were also equally, I think, influenced by the power pop sort of thing, like bands like, if you think of like the Replacements and Cheap Trick. So there's this interesting combination in this band, the Jayhawks, of this kind of roots thing and then also this power pop thing. If you're a fan of a band like Big Star, which was a band in the 70s, these guys kind of have that sort of a sound. And they're going around on a tour. They just re-released three of their most popular albums from the 90s. Those albums were Sound of Lies, Smile, and Rainy Day Music. They're playing a lot of songs from that sort of trio of albums as well as things from their entire career. Apparently, these shows are really well rehearsed, really well organized, and really long. They're coming October 27th.
Really long.
They're coming on October 27th to the Somerville Theater. Let's have a little listen to the Jayhawks. I think this is a song that really kind of gets at their sound. A lot of great harmonies in what they do. This song's called Stumbling Through the Dark.
The men who preceded us here left only questions and fears. The vanity formed by beauty lies. You know it's a crime.
I did not expect that sound when
yes.
you described it.
I mean,
not that you didn't describe it well, it's just that I do hear that roots, but there's something else going on with it. It's not just sort of old-time country.
No. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's also, they've also got this power pop thing. So these sort of principles of power pop. They've got these great harmonies.
Right.
And like I said, if you listen, and there's a certain sort of odd quality to what the Jayhawks do. There's a lot of bands that kind of exist in this mold, but the Jayhawks, for me, sort of stand in a different place because just from a musical standpoint, they have a point of view. And there's a little bit of quirk and oddity, especially into their voices and especially into the harmonies.
Yeah.
What century are you going to, Brian? No, seriously, what century?
So seriously, actually, we're going to come to the current century.
Ooh, I love that.
In a certain sense, because, I'm so excited. I should say, by the way, that you mentioned the other stuff on the website, the links to stuff on the website. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that it's always hard to do these because there's so many great things that I can't mention, we can't get into. And there's a lot of other great concerts coming up that I looked at and that will be highlighted on the website. So things like the Lexington Symphony, the Boston Philharmonic, Chameleon Arts Ensemble, great organizations around town giving great concerts. But I'm so excited about the previous orchestras I mentioned because it gives you a chance to hear them in relation to our own world-class orchestra. And of course, the big story in town has been Andras Nelson's. He'll be in town for 3 weeks during November. And when I say current century, I mean they'll be doing a world premiere that was commissioned for Andras Nelson's coming here. A world premiere by a Latvian composer, because he's from Latvia. And so that's going to be on one of these programs that he's conducting. He'll also be conducting a piece by a Russian composer named Sofia Gubaidulina, who is still with us and wrote this amazing mystical piece. And then he'll also be doing other things like Tchaikovsky. And let's see, Rachmaninoff, Yo-Yo Ma will be playing with. So there's a huge, I'm not going to run down the whole laundry list of pieces because it's just a bit much to absorb at one time. But I want to highlight the Sibelius Second Symphony simply because it gets in your ear this way of orchestra sounding. Let's go ahead and hear a little bit of the Sibelius II. This is the last movement in a Boston Symphony recording that's legendary now. It's with Colin Davis. And the thing about Sibelius II is that it all depends on pacing. And it depends on this gradual, inexorable buildup. So if you're in the hall, nothing comes at you in a slap at the face. It's like you're on this wave and you're just getting carried away with this sound that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Let's go ahead and ramp it up a little bit. So there's this motion under everything.
Yeah.
And the melody is sort of circular. We're back at the beginning of it now. but it feels like we're somehow farther along than we were before. And they're adding instruments, it's layering on, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the thing about Sibelius is that the pacing is so important. It's a great test of how a conductor handles an orchestra. The biggest thing about any conductor and orchestra relationship is timing. And the sense of timing for keeping a steady beat, and the sense of timing for knowing when to not keep a steady beat. And that's what's going to be really fascinating to watch with Andras and the BSO.
Look how happy Marjorie Yen is. I mean, this is just, she is like in another place. It is so, it really, no, it's great to see. It's incredible. Okay, Rob Hochschild, take it away, my friend.
All right. Well, there are two people I'm going to tell you about right now. Preston Reed and Usman Riaz. And these are two guitarists that are... approach their instrument in ways that we've never heard before. There's a lot of percussive. These guys will tap on the instrument. They will pluck the strings in various locations. They have a whole different way of playing. The interesting thing is now they're playing on November 4th at the Berklee Performance Center. The way they came together was this 23-year-old Usman Riaz, who's from Pakistan, learned how to play by watching YouTube and by seeing what these great guitarists in other parts of the world played like. He watched Jimmy Page play, I believe, Braniar Stomp, which is a tune from one of the Led Zeppelin albums, and figured out how to play it. And from there, he started listening to other guitarists and eventually came across this guy, Preston Reed. And Preston Reed...
Sounds like an iPad commercial. Right?
Yeah, exactly. One thing led to another. And this guy has... not only is he a great guitar player, he also composes symphonies and he plays piano. And he is currently a Berklee student, but he's done so many things beyond that. He did a TED Talk in Scotland, and that was the first time he and his idol Preston Reed came together. They both played, and then they were interviewed. And so now they're coming together to do a full concert for the first time, November 4th at Berklee. Let's listen to a little bit of these guys from the TED Talk.
You know, the way you described him, I thought it was going to sound like Rodrigo or Gabriela.
Yeah, it's so yeah. Yeah, totally.
But it's actually not. Totally. It's not
it's
really
not
the
unlike
same thing.
It, though. I mean, it's no. sort of it's coming a from a different place, but it's got that same,
Why is this guy still a student, Rob? What is he a student of?
What does he get? I know.
What's the point?
What does he have to learn?
No, I mean that sincerely.
That is a great question. You know, I think one of the many things that people get out of going to school at Berklee is the network and meeting other musicians and other producers, business people. That's a big part of it. And also just figuring out some other stuff and going further. I mean, he's a young guy. So, I think of an album called Friday Night in San Francisco when I listen to this, which is an album from the 70s, Al Di Meola, John McLaughlin. Just virtuoso guitar players doing amazing things rhythmically and melodically. And I think that's where these guys are cool coming from. So great stuff.
Okay, an impossible task, particularly for Edgar and Brian.
Keep
you
it
have
short.
1 minute
what are you trying to
each.
Say? All right, here we go.
1 minute, Edgar Beharick III.
So we're in the 2000s. This is a rock and roll band from Long Beach, California. Really interesting. They've just released their second album. Their first album came out about 4 or 5 years ago. When the kid was signed to Sub Pop Records, he was just 18 years old, put this first album out, which was really, really great. The second album is sort of a step in maturity. I think of this as sort of a split between, you know, there's one part that sounds like the music of the late 90s, like a band like The Shins. And then there's this other part, because this guy is a really good guitar player, that has this Grateful Dead quality to it, which is kind of buried in the background. But while a lot of it is kind of big, rockin', kind of guitar music with strange melodies, he's got a really high voice, I've chosen a track from their new album that is a little bit more of a mature and contemplative moment that kind of indicates, I think... a more interesting direction where this young man is going. But here's a track. The band is called Avi Buffalo, and this is a track called Overwhelmed with Pride.
Emotions paint and pushing wheels spinning through your wall. Over ease, over eggs and
yeah, hang with it for 1 second here, this beautiful kind of rising moment.
Sounds like he's walking on a cloud.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think one reviewer said you can imagine Kermit the Frog singing this song, which is kind of funny and kind of true.
Oh,
but these guys are really good. They're playing November 8th at Great Scott, which is a small venue in Alston. Always a really good place to see a show with a band like this. So Avi Buffalo, I highly recommend this one. I think it's going to be a good show. They have two records, and they both are packed with really good music.
Okay, Brian McCreath, you're going to end this month's Concert Roundtable.
And I'll bring it full circle. Back to Hollywood.
Yes.
Eric Korngold. Composer born in Vienna, child prodigy. Mahler thought he was the best thing ever. Moved to the Hollywood
Mahler,
in 1930s.
By the way, I thought we were going to get through it.
No,
you weren't
going to
talk about Mahler.
No. So he moves to Hollywood in the 1930s to escape the Anschluss. Starts writing film scores. Loves writing film scores. Still kind of pines away for a classical career. St. Lawrence String Quartet coming to the Rockport Chamber Music Organization on October 25th at the Chalindu Performance Center. They'll be playing a Korngold String Quartet. Let's hear a little bit of it. This is a piece. This is the third movement of the third string quartet by Korngold. And what's really nice about this is that he actually used music from the film score for The Sea Wolf,
Ooh.
One of the golden age Hollywood films.
If only one of the Newman family had written that.
Exactly.
I mean, how perfect
did
would
I
that
say
have
it
been?
Was full circle? We're coming back to Hollywood. St. Lawrence String Quartet, one of the great quartets working right now. They're based in California. They're coming to Rockport on October 25th.
It's beautiful. Edgar B. Herrick III, Rob Hochschild, Brian McCreath, thank you as always.
Our pleasure.
Thank
and we'll
you.
See you next month. This
yes,
is
we have
too.
Been. Okay, let me just say once again, Rob Hochschild is the Director of Communications for Berklee College of Music. Brian McCreath is the host with 99.5 really WCRB and the producer for the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast. And Edgar B. Herrick III is with WGBH's Curiosity Desk. Thanks again for coming in.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Up next, Emily Rooney joins us for Open Mic and her famous list of obsessions and observations. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We'll explain in a minute while we're playing that music. She doesn't even know why. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. When she's not, I don't know, in the middle of a Hood Milk blimp floating over Fenway Park, or gearing up in her hazmat suit to decontaminate hazardous sites, or wearing her leather cat suit and hanging out with Aerosmith's Joe Perry, who you're listening to, she takes time out to join us on Friday afternoons. That, of course, is the host of Greater Boston, the great Emily Rooney. Hello there, Emily.
Hello my week. Marge, Jim, always happy to be here.
So we opened up our Boston Globe and read through it. What morning was that? We turned
couple
the page.
Days ago.
Yesterday.
The names page, and there was Emily in full leather.
Absolutely.
Standing next to
with Joe Perry
Perry.
From Aerosmith.
Perry,
How was he, by the way?
It was a bit of a tough interview. I mean, I'm going to make a big segment out of it for next week, but he speaks very slowly and methodically. I thought the book was really good. I really, really enjoyed it. I've read a lot of the Aerosmith books, but I thought this one had incredible detail and honesty.
Well, let's get back to this leather dress. Did you buy it specifically for the occasion? Or did you have
it? I had it.
Really? And where did you wear it previously?
You don't even want to know. Well, I've worn it to a couple of events.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Full leather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
She was out with Steven Tyler the night before, and she wore
Do you know
it
that
then?
I got a degree with him in 2004?
You did not.
I was
college?
The speaker for UMass Boston.
Oh, that was a controversial speech you made. Your speech
I
was,
know.
If you recall. I remember.
Do I recall?
We've never discussed
I've
this,
never,
but that was
I've
controversial.
Never, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah,
what
let's
did
not
you
get,
say?
No, it's, whatever.
We
Google
can't?
It. Let's look it up.
Yeah, that was.
Okay.
Sorry I brought it up.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. So, Emily, you are a little upset. I'm not sure on which about the Ebola coverage this week. What is your issue with the Ebola coverage?
Actually, even
please?
With my own program, because I've had some great guests on. Last night we had this expert from MGH, Hillary Cranmer. I mean, she was brilliant. She was great. But she kept saying, like every other guest they've had this week, is it's basically impossible to get. You're not going to get it. Even this woman who was on the airplane, if she didn't have symptoms, you're not going to get it. So it's like, well, why are we even worrying about these hazmat suits and all this? It's like, first of all, we don't believe that. I mean,
we
I don't believe it. No one believes that. I mean, how did these two nurses get it? They weren't. They were being careful, you know, from Thomas Duncan. How did they get it? I think we don't know. I'm skeptical. I think we don't know the full story about how you get it. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I don't know. But otherwise, why are we obsessing this way?
I think it's pretty. First of all, well, most of us are not going to be.
They don't believe it.
Not going to be in a hospital room with Thomas Duncan.
Yeah.
The media is. I mean, I hate to say this, sound the same tired theme we often do. The media is playing this virtually 24/7. And when you have the President of the United States release videos almost every single
Ebola
day,
czar. He appointed an Ebola czar.
Did you see the Ebola czar? He was sort of unimpressive looking.
Well, you know, what does that do with anything?
You should have
former
hired
chief
like
of staff
Clint
to Al Gore
or something
or
to be the
Romney.
Mitt Romney, that would have been a great Ebola czar. Yeah. What an opportunity.
Well, you know what's
missed?
Interesting about this? Because you have to assume that before the president breaks into something, and one was a cabinet meeting 2 days ago, yesterday he's having a meeting in his office, you have to assume they've done research to say what he's got to say and whatever. He is talking about the most basic things that when you hear it, you say to yourself, it's not possible that the average person doesn't know that you can't get it this way.
But we then don't believe it.
But then you talk to people who are relatively smart, who are your friends, and people are both scared and wildly uninformed.
But if I just told you that I had been exposed to somebody who had Ebola, but I don't have any symptoms, would you be nervous?
Yes.
Yes.
That's
yes,
the point.
I would. Yeah, I would.
I mean, we don't believe that.
But I think it's a basic distrust in the government now because of so many, I mean, with the NSA and the IRS and all these other things, you don't know if they're telling you the truth. They don't have
Barack Obama
is a very secretive president.
They don't seem to know the truth.
Well, they may not know the truth. They may not know the truth.
If they're struggling that hard to figure out how these two nurses got exposed, it's like maybe it wasn't all that hard. Maybe it wasn't as hard to get as everybody's telling us.
Well, also, it does sound like the gang couldn't shoot straight. I mean, every day there's an apology for something. You know what the saddest part of this is? Speaking of fear and lack of knowledge and whatever, I didn't know this till this week. The largest Liberian-American population in the United States is in Minnesota. I had this guy, this pastor, Torley Crua, on the other night, who's been working on refugee issues forever in Boston. We were talking about a story where tons of parents in Minnesota will not allow their children to play with their friends who were born in Minnesota, who were Liberian American, tons of them, because of the fear, well, they may have Liberian friends and who knows.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just how painful is that?
Pulling kids home from school and that sort of
thing. Oh, yes.
Really, I mean, people are over the top about it.
But, you know, but getting back to the underlying theme, particularly since Beat the Press is, I don't know if you're covering it.
We are.
Part of the reason why people don't believe it is because this is 24-7. I just looked at CNN on the screen. I can't believe
they're actually
talking about ISIS for a minute.
Yeah. No,
but essentially, it is Ebola 24. That woman, that nurse who's sort of the whistleblower out of the hospital, she has been on every show virtually nonstop
Live
for 24 hours.
Bed. So Shep Smith from Fox News took on the news media. We're going to be talking about that and Beat the Press tonight. But he was berating the news media for hyperventilating over this, for exaggerating. I mean, we went back and looked at a lot of the coverage. We're not really finding that that's necessarily true. I mean, reporting the facts, like the fact that they let that woman on the airplane after she called in and said she wasn't feeling well, that's a fact.
Yeah, but
that's
I don't think it's exaggerating. Can I tell you, I don't think it's exaggeration or hyperventilation. It is the nonstop nature of it.
Well, that's
what most of us believe, if something is on 24/7, then it must be a serious issue.
How about the woman on the cruise?
Yeah, that's another one.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
Okay,
Ebola-like symptoms. What's that other disease that everybody gets on a cruise ship?
I don't know.
What's that
one
called?
Flu thing or something. Everybody's got to run around with their Purell. I don't know.
I can't remember the name of that one. But you get
Carnival
it through the
cruise once
you
again.
Get it through the air. It's airborne through.
Oh,
the
I thought you meant
Legionnaire's disease.
Yeah. I thought the disease you meant you get.
Don't you remember that?
When you go to five all-you-can-eat buffets in 24 hours. That's another disease. That
Okay. Let's move on. What are we moving on to?
We're moving on to Farrah
Stockman.
Yes. Globe Report.
Now, explain what happened to Farrah Stockman, please.
So she sits down to watch some TV the other day and turns on and up pops her image in a Martha Coakley Super PAC ad. It's a pro-choice Super PAC ad. She'd gone to a barbecue last summer. It's one of those barbecues that everybody shows up to, all the candidates. And this was before the primary, so there were a lot of candidates. That
whose barbecue
up.
Was?
Oh,
Tito Jackson's turkey fry.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, City
I know
Council,
the turkey fry.
So some photographer from Martha Coakley takes a picture, posts it on her Flickr page. a super PAC just mines it right off the page, puts it in the ad, has no idea who Farrah Stockman is. Farrah complains, they take it down. But this is very common. Like that super PAC ad pro Charlie Baker right now, using that clip from Channel 5's On the Record, where Martha Coakley mm-hmm. couldn't answer the question
the
about
the gas tax.
Yeah. I've been in many, many ads. I've been in a couple of Mitt Romney ads, anti-Mitt Romney ads. I was just looking today, Tom Brokaw, you know, got into a big dust-up with Mitt Romney. And the media has lost this fight, which is why it's kind of interesting.
Do you ask out of these things?
We have many times.
See, my view is I haven't been in as many as you, but when I'm in,
no, but
I haven't.
Upset about that, by the way.
I am upset about it. But when I'm in them, not because I'm sitting in Tito's backyard, but because I'm asking somebody a question. I mean, that's what I do and what you do for a living. So. Yeah. Why is – that doesn't suggest I'm supporting or opposing a candidate.
Well,
does it or does
it? Well, no, in the Farrah case
– Farrah's a different story.
They were very close to each other. They were smiling at each
other. I don't know. I've gotten over it. At first, it really annoyed me because it felt like, well, journalists are supposed to be neutral even. So if they're being put into a situation where they – like this Tom Brokaw spot, which really pointed because he was reporting the facts about Newt Gingrich, about his congressional colleagues wanting him censured or whatever it was. But it sounded really, really negative, and it made it sound like Tom Brokaw was anti-Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the problem. So if you're put into a context where it seems like you're taking a side, that's why we've protested.
Well, you also, in Farrah Stockman's piece about her own dilemma with this Martha Coakley thing, she talks about people who have been involved in politics know this, is all these ads you see, not all of them, a lot of the ads you see with video or pictures of people who allegedly have a particular position are just stock photos that have been taken off the internet. And she called this one guy who's fairly famous in the trade and said it's a lot cheaper to pull a photo off the internet to have a photo shoot with real people. So it's conceivable the people who are pictured, most of whom probably aren't famous, like Farrah Stockman from The Globe, don't even support or don't even know who the candidate or issue is.
And a lot of the people who appear in those ads are actors.
Yeah, I mean, which is, to me, even worse, by the way.
Well, they had this great anecdote in here about some guy that made the ad.
Republicans, that's the guy I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, Republicans are people, too, and it shows attractive people doing apparently Democratic things, like Republicans recycle, said the ad, and Republicans drive Priuses, and Republicans
These
are black.
What do Democrats do? Like, spend money they don't have? What is it that they're allegedly doing?
They drive Priuses, and they're black.
I'm sorry.
And then he was wildly ridiculed when it found out that people were all actors. That's kind of a weird thing, too.
Yeah, it is
weird. You have to go out and find an actor because you can't find a Republican driving a Prius.
Well, you can.
You want somebody to really fit your profile.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
And look good and look appealing and that sort of thing. Now, earlier today, we did this at 11 o'clock. Marjorie and I were both blown away, I think is a fair statement, by the fact that the former three-time governor, former presidential candidate in 1988, Michael Dukakis, walks into the trial of the friend of the most hated alleged terrorist in the United States, Robel Philippos, who obviously is the friend, school friend in Cambridge of Jahar Tsarnaev. And, you know, he's charged with lying to FBI agents, could face, I think you said, Marjorie, up to 14 years. And he testifies as a character witness. We're both saying we couldn't name on one hand five politicians who would ever
Though he was a family friend. If you ask most politicians to stand up for a family friend, and this is family friend once removed because he's the son of family friends, they wouldn't do it. I agree.
So what is – I mean – and by the way, I theorize, and you've known him longer than I have, but I've known him for a while, that the fact that he's 80 and out of office has nothing to do with it.
Not
if he
really.
Was governor or running for president, and he's asked
also
to do it.
I think he has the sensibility that I believe the three of us have, which is like, this is – way overreaching.
Oh, I think it is way overreaching.
These kids need to be charged with chronic stupidity, and we need to move on. I mean, getting them any jail time beyond what they've already gotten, it just seems wrong to me.
Oh, I think this is another case, and I hope somebody at some point looks into it, of the federal government and Carmen Ortiz, who's the U.S. attorney, just overcharging in these situations that are ridiculous. And there's like they mostly involve young men that are 18, 19,
stupid.
20, 21, doing stupid things. I mean, not to excuse, second that they seemed to be not doing what they should have done involving a guy who just set off bombs on Boylston
Street.
They weren't thinking. Yeah. And really high. It seemed
this guy was anyway.
But the thing that gets me about this is that yet again, it's an example of the FBI not taping, not recording, not writing down what went on in these interviews, whole sections, we don't know. And it drives me nuts that we take this over and over again from the Whitey Bulger case and up again to this
case. And why don't they record interviews?
I think they don't record them because they don't want to know.
They don't want us
to know how
they
want
to be able to characterize it in any way. Yeah. That, yeah. Well, that's not, of course.
Yeah. And he says he was questioned for 5 hours yeah. without a lawyer by the FBI. Mm-hmm. And what is he, 20 years old?
Yeah. He was 19.
And he was a stoner on top yeah. of the whole thing, high as a kite. So it just makes me very uneasy that is somebody wrote this, the whole power of the federal government coming down on people. Yeah. You better hope the federal government doesn't come down
Harvey,
on you.
Harvey Silverglate, he's your go-to guy on that.
Well, but also some of the most powerful things I've ever seen on the power of the federal government is, I can't remember, the frontline thing. Was it Michael Kirk who did the thing we had in here?
Yes.
Who did the thing on the NSA, who these lifelong patriotic employees of the NSA whose lives were ruined.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
destroyed.
That's the
divorces,
other
bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy in many cases because you have to go out and hire a lawyer for hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend yourself. Now, this kid, I don't know what his situation is, but I think it's a single woman. She's
his
from
mother,
Ethiopia. He's got two lawyers with him marching into the courtroom yeah. every day. I mean, you know, I don't know how she's paying for these people. I don't know what
I
the
think
deal
the father is.
Is
still in the picture.
I think
but
the
maybe
answer is.
Well, in any case, I'm sure who can afford $200,000 for a lawyer? It's just, it drives me nuts.
Okay, enough with Rebel Philippos and Michael Dukakis, and now on to this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
God, do I love that. Now, in any case, Marjorie, I always have the privilege every week of asking, is it thematic? Why don't you ask this week?
Okay, Emily Rooney, do you have a theme this week?
I did it, and I need to explain it just for a second because I promise
your
you, you're going to be amused.
Okay.
But the lead up is not amusing.
All right.
So I got a couple of emails this week about the opening of this opera, The Death of Klinghoffer. Which the opera's been around for decades, and it's the story of Leon Klinghoffer who gets thrown off the Achilleloro and
in a wheelchair, right?
In a wheelchair. So the Metropolitan Opera is opening it's been around for decades, but they are staging it opening on Monday, and there's been a lot of emails flying back and forth. Zionist groups are claiming the thing is anti-Semitic, and that the New York Times is kind of bought into the anti-Semitism. So I'm thinking, well, maybe this is a story for me. Maybe I've got something here for Beat the Press. So I read all the news stories, and frankly, they played it totally even-handedly. So I said, you know what? I think I'll check out the reviews of the opera. Forget the news stories. I'm going to go to the reviews. I go to the reviews. You guys are not going to believe what I found.
All right. We're ready.
My list today is called Get Me Rewrite.
Get Me Rewrite.
Are you ready for that?
We're ready, yes.
And by the way, this is from all kinds of reviews. The New York Times, the LA Times, the New Yorker, everybody.
These are all reviews of the same play.
Yeah.
Okay.
It gives passionate voice to the views of its characters, inflaming any perverted believer who can countenance no utterance of an opposing view. Perverted. The opera's greatest profundity is that it contrives to transform our active listening and witnessing into a parallel model for the process of civilized discourse.
Wait a minute. Where's this from?
I told you. I'm not going to. These are all
real.
Real.
But are you going to identify which one this
is? I decided not to.
Oh, why?
I could.
Just
come
go
on.
Ahead.
What is it? Where's it from?
It's her list or is it your list?
The visual spectacle in the Felicitas Theater in Long Beach suggests a scale suitably both epochal and intimate. It artistically equips the audience with the emotional insight to process the intractably insupportable and experience the suggestion of a possibility for even incremental movement forward.
That's true. I mean, that's awesome.
Absolutely.
The overwrought imagery and sheer opacity of Goodman's text only exacerbate it. The sheer beauty of so much of Adam's score with its dark-hued sonorities, chromatically inflected harmonies, and keening instrumental lines.
Mm.
This searing, mystical, and ambitious work, without the doctrinaire baggage that has attached to it over the years, as the Palestinians tell of their suffering, the vocal lines in the chorus are set with elegiac lyricism, rich with melismas that extend the phrases exotically.
What are melismas?
I have no
it's
idea.
Some, I had to look that up.
Oh, what is it?
It's some bunch of notes or tunes together.
Okay, fine.
The choral writing for the exiled Jews is thickly textured and shrouded with luminous, yet pointedly astringent harmonies.
Mm. Luminous, but
I have
pointedly
to say,
astringent
I mean,
harmonies.
You always know this, that I hate to say it because you just had a bunch of really great music people.
They were great.
But anybody who does theater, movie, I hate to say it, it's just a cliche. They come up with these unbelievably pretentious descriptives to the point where you have no idea what they're talking about.
That's true.
And so I couldn't decide whether they were Semitic or anti-Semitic or whatever the thing it is. It's just like it was incomprehensible
to me.
Did
they say at the end, did they say good, bad, mediocre, or did we never really figure out what they thought?
They seemed to like it.
They seemed to like it. We weren't sure.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, so that's
chromatically inflected harmonies and keening instrument. It's like what?
So you're
going
to force us to have to look this up ourselves. But the New Yorker, the New York Times, and the LA Times are at least three of your sources here. Yeah,
there was one that I got a lot from.
Which was that?
I took it out. I intentionally eliminated it.
Really?
And then I mixed it up so I wouldn't remember.
Wow.
Do you know that
I decided not to attribute.
Do you know we had Harvard linguist Steven Pinker in here?
Yes, we did. I was here for that.
Talking about his book about how to write. He's going to be in the bestseller list. He's going to be like number seven.
Really? Is that really true?
I believe it. Yeah.
Do you think people enjoy reading this kind
of
writing?
No.
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, I would tell you that usually the people that are worse, you know, the lawyerly briefs, but that's pretty bad.
They're not writing for real people. They're writing for other critics.
But at
they're
least
writing...
lawyerly briefs is legal terminology.
Right.
You either understand it or you don't. They're reading. This is for us.
Yeah.
Well, it's not for us because I don't understand what they're talking about.
Neither do I. Okay,
so are they writing for each other?
Yeah, I think they are. What are you doing on Beat the Press tonight?
Well, we're going to be talking about Farrah Stockman, and we are going to look at the Ebola issue, whether the media has been fair. And then we're taking a look at CNN and MSNBC, who have just kind of like, you know, losing viewership and laying off hundreds of people and really raising the question whether you know, all these 24 News cable operations are sustainable at this point with so many other options and, you know, so much other.
But MSNBC, which was exploding in a positive way a few, six, 8 months ago, is really, it was a New York Times story the other day, right?
Yeah,
saying
how
it's disappearing its audience.
One last thing I want to ask you, though. CNN, in a big crisis, is kind of where you go. So I don't understand how it is that they're always at the bottom of the ratings.
Yeah, like when the Malaysian Airlines 370 disappeared, they were doing really well.
Or
they're
ISIS,
trying to do really well with Ebola, but I don't think they are.
I don't know. I mean, you have to have someone giving you they're there giving you the news 24/7, and if there's a crisis, you want to have someplace to turn to. I personally am going to be very upset, much as I love Anthony Bourdain running around the great restaurants of the world, if there's not a place for me to tune to.
They're going to be all documentaries in the not-too-distant future you watch. That's what it is every night. Remember, it used to be Larry King, used to be Piers Morgan. Now it's a documentary, an original documentary every single night.
Anyway, I'm going to the opening of Death of Hawker, and I'm going to be writing my own.
Okay.
Good to see Emily Rooney. Watching tonight at 7.
All right. Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for Open Mic. Of course, you can keep up with her weeknights at Channel 2 at 7 o'clock for Greater Boston and on Friday nights for Beat the Press. Up next, it's our Friday news quiz. Two members of a burlesque circus crew take us on the week's headlines. That conversation is next. 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for our Friday News Quiz are Sarah Honeywell and Chuck Lachine Jr. Chuck's the founder and creative director of the Boston Circus Guild, as well as Emperor Norton's Stationary Marching Band. Sarah plays trombone in Emperor Norton's Stationary Marching Band. They're both performing in Cirque of the Dead, which is a macabre night of circus, live music, and gore. It's at Club Oberon. Oh, it is. At Club Oberon, October 23rd through the end of the month. Sarah and Chuck, it's great to meet you both.
You too. Thanks for having us.
Okay. Now, before we get on all the details of Cirque of the Dead, please tell me first about the Boston Circus Guild. What is it?
So the Boston Circus Guild is a professional organization of circus performers from the New England area focused in the Boston metro region. We have the top circus talent in New England, I would say, and we book for all kinds of events, corporate events, social events, that kind of thing. We also produce our own shows, which is what we're doing this Halloween as a part of being artists in residence at the American Repertory Theater.
So when you say you book for events, you'll go to a corporate event and do what?
Anything. We have a huge roster of people. So we have contortionists, aerialists, acrobats, fire performers, hand balancers, hula hoopers, you know, just everything, you name it, plus a whole range of live musicians.
Are either of you contortionists? I love contortionists. Are either of you? No, that's really
definitely
too bad.
Not.
I'm
definitely
so
not.
Disappointed. So, Sarah, you are a trombone player in Emperor Norton Stationary Marching Band performing in Cirque of the Dead. What's that like? What's the marching band? Who are these people?
Oh, man. So there's 15 to 20 of us on a good day for in Emperor Norton. I play trombone. There's...
How many on a bad day? What does that mean?
I mean, a bad day, we can probably do a gig with
I was
going to
say maybe
people.
The 17-person days are the bad days.
Bad days.
And
I think the smallest we've ever performed as Emperor Norton was around 8 people.
I think 7 or 8.
It just depends on the instrumentation. It has to be the right 7 or 8 people. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so people go to Cirque of the Dead, if I'm pronouncing it properly,
correct.
Starting with you, Chuck. So what do they get? What's the performance like? What's the deal?
So it's a... about an hour and a half circus show, sort of modern vaudeville style, comedy, variety acts of astounding amazingness and gore and sextacular sort of things.
You look so music. Much like a ringmaster. Are you a ringmaster? No,
well,
I'm serious.
Say,
you
like,
are so ringmaster-esque.
The mustache, is professional.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
People ask all the time if the mustache is real. It's a thing.
Yeah. It happens frequently.
Is it real?
It is. Oh, yeah. No, I work very hard on this mustache.
How do you get the ends to twirl up like they
mustache
twirl?
Mustache wax.
Mustache
That's the
wax.
Only way
okay.
To do it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the ART before. So what's your connection again to the ART?
So last fall, they started an artist in residence program at Oberon specifically.
Okay.
So we've been working with them, and they chose the Boston Cirque Guild along with two other production companies. And it's a 3-year residency program, and we've got to work closely with producers there and closer with the technical staff of Oberon.
Oh,
it's really
neat.
Allowed us to make bigger and better shows than we've ever been able to do there before, which we've been doing for about 4 or 5 years now. But this is sort of a new level of production for us.
You know, Sarah, we had a music roundtable, concert roundtable about an hour ago, and we were talking to Rob Hochschild from the Berklee School of Music. And Marjorie asked, I think, we were playing, what's her name? Tia Fuller is the name of the
yes.
woman who's doing alto sax. And Marjorie said, how many women are doing alto sax? And he said, these days, quite a few. How many women are doing trombone in 2014?
I think more so than there ever was before. I grew up in a small town in Vermont playing trombone since 5th grade, and there was one other girl who quit pretty quickly thereafter. But I graduated from Berklee. Yeah. So,
oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh. Did you pick it, or was it one of these things that was the last instrument left, and so you had it there, and then you did a trombone player?
I picked it.
So what's the allure of the trombone?
I had a cousin that was much like an older brother to me. I'm an only child, so he played, so I played. And then there was 1 year in high school where we were there together, and I was better than him. I beat him at all the regional auditions, and he didn't speak to me for months. It was very
gosh.
Sad. But
they're heavy.
A little bit. I mean,
yeah.
it's like playing a tuning slide, so it's a lot to do with the ears. You got to really listen, but it's fun, and it makes awesome, crazy noises.
How heavy are they?
Actual weight, I'm not sure. It would
depend. We have much heavier instruments in our band.
Like a what?
A
accordion,
sousaphone.
Oh, yeah, of course.
What's a sousaphone?
A sousaphone's a marching tuba.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, now before we start this thing, since you said you're an only child and I'm an only child, how many times in your life, Sarah Honeywell, when someone has known you and you say, I'm an only child, they say, aha, that explains everything. Have you ever had that?
I've had that, but they've also said that I was very well adjusted in my adult life.
I haven't had that. But I've had the first half, I've not had the second. So this is Chuck Lesheen and Sarah Honeywell from the Boston Circus Guild. And who do you want to start with, Marjorie?
I'll start with Chuck.
Okay, do
you
it.
Ready, Chuck?
Sure.
Okay, here is your first question. The city of Chicago just achieved a dubious distinction among major American cities. What was it? Here is Jimmy Kimmel with a clue.
The number one most infested city in the United States, you know what it is? Chicago. Yeah, New York is 4th. That surprised me. But I think the report's a little bit misleading. The list is based on the number of calls Orkin, the pest control company, got last year in each city. In New York, if you see a you don't even bother to call. You live in an old building in New York, are considered to be roommates. All you can do is ask them to pitch in on rent and hope for the best.
Okay, do you know what was the dubious distinction achieved by Chicago?
That they have the most roaches?
No, that is wrong. That's what I would have guessed. Okay. You can steal the question, Sarah.
I was going to guess roaches, too. Rats?
That
rats.
Is exactly
you
correct.
You are right. So you get the first point. There you go. Orkin pest control.
Is there anything more disgusting than a rat, by the way?
No.
I mean, they're really horrible.
They're gross.
Roaches.
Yuck.
Roaches
are pretty gross.
You want to see when I lived in New York City? This is horrible, but since you brought up roaches, this is – don't look at me that way, Sarah. I would put a piece of cheese on the counter in my kitchen. I would turn the light off for 60 seconds, and when I turned the light back on, I could often not see the piece. Oh, look at Chuck.
Oh, that's gross.
Could not see the piece.
Sorry, there are no bugs in Cirque of the Dead.
Bugs freak me out.
Is that really true?
Yeah, no, bugs really freak me out.
It's a little embarrassing, Chuck. Okay, Sarah, here's your question. You can take a two-point lead. What well-known green thumb and health nut stars in a new video hyping turnips? Here's the video, all 6 seconds of it.
Turnip for what?
Okay, do you know who the well-known green thumb and health nut who starred in that turnip video might be?
Michelle Obama.
That is exactly. How'd you know that, Bob? Have you seen that thing?
I saw the video.
Yeah, it's pretty great, by the way. What do you think about? Are you why are you smiling about it? Because you think of the
cockroaches. I like the song. I hadn't seen this.
What
I
is
like,
with the cockroach thing with you? Can we get back to that for 1 second? What's up with that?
I'd rather not.
Really? Okay.
You left it out. Did you get after you put the piece of cheese and had the cockroaches covered? Did you get out with a paddle and squish them all, or what did you do?
I think I've gone too far. But the answer. Well, actually, look at all of our staff. Our colleagues are all disgusted. They were lonely nights in New York City.
If you really want to be disgusted, you should come see Cirque of the Dead.
By the way, speaking of...
Because it's gore.
What does gore mean, by the way? What does that mean there?
Well, so it's bloody and scary, but it's also funny. It's definitely going to be an intense sensory experience as far as immersive theater goes. So it's not for the faint of heart. Definitely.
Where's Club Oberon for those who don't know?
It's Harvard Square, just outside of Harvard Square.
By the way, the beauty is, I don't know if it's your show, but when you go by Club Oberon, I live a few blocks away, like on a Saturday night when there's a performance, and a lot of the performers come out on the street, it is really, it's this great, great feel and thing. Do you guys do the street thing or you just do inside?
For this show,
we just do inside. Well, I'm really glad I brought it up then.
It's a weird thing, Chuck. You're scared of bugs, but the blood and the gore.
That's okay.
It's okay. Yeah. All right. That's okay.
You know that they are older than any living creature on the planet. Do you know that? The cockroaches?
Yes.
As he swallows, as I say this. Next question for Chuck.
Okay. And they will long outlast us.
Here we go, Chuck. Who's upset by the new season of TV series American Horror Story? Here is Craig Ferguson with a hint.
There's a group called the of America are speaking out against the way that they're depicted on television. They're especially angry at the show American Horror Story. The president of the of America says they should be treated with dignity and respect, which sounds to me like they don't really want to be treated like.
Okay, do you know who's upset by the new season?
The clowns of America.
Yes.
Wow. How do you know? You've ever heard of this group?
Did you see the show?
Yes. I'm a circus professional.
I guess you would.
It's not that big a world.
The clown murdered those two lovely lovers.
Clowns really get a bad rap these days.
Yeah.
But you know that clowns, talk about cockroach. I was just going to say, clowns apparently are scarier to children than virtually anything on the planet. Do you know that, Marjorie?
I did not know that.
Well, you know it
now.
Did
you just make that up?
No, I did not. Chuck is shaking his head. He knows what he's talking about.
All right.
I didn't know that. The score, I think, is 2-1. You, Sarah, you can go out to a huge 3-1 lead. There was some exciting news in the world of TV this week. Conan O'Brien of Brookline, I should say, explains.
We'll soon offer a paid subscription service. Yeah. That means you can continue to watch for free, or you can pay for it. It's your call. You decide how you want to handle that one.
And here's the question off that, Sarah. Who announced they're rolling out a paid subscription service just this week? Who was it?
HBO.
Well,
right?
That is true, but it's not the answer to this question. Oh. Do you know what the answer is, Chuck, there?
Oh, I do.
The key part, I'll give you a little hint so we can try to even this baby up. He says you can get blank for free or you can pay for it. It's your call. Does that help you out at all? Apparently not.
Because you already get it for free.
Okay, and the answer is CBS. And you were right, Sarah. HBO also announced they're introducing a standalone web subscription service.
I think that says something, doesn't it?
What is it?
That you wouldn't even know about CBS, but you know about HBO.
I don't actually have television.
See, there you go.
For a decade, I've never had cable. Yeah. So.
Give her half a point for not having television.
Yes.
Okay, fine.
You can watch stuff on your computer, like through Netflix.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, it's like it's becoming a big
thing.
Well,
let me ask you a question, Sarah. How do you watch my television show on New England Cable News every night at 6 o'clock and 7:30?
cable television show.
Okay, fine. Thank you. That is not going to be helpful
Sorry.
In the future.
Okay,
now, before we go ahead, actually, we'll get back to this in a second. Continue. I'm sorry.
I'm mixed up. Who's
You're
turn
on.
Is it?
It's your turn. You're asking this. Well, actually, who is? Where were we, judges? Are we through four questions?
I think it's Sarah's turn, isn't it? No, it's your. Is it your turn? Chuck's
sure.
turn. Okay.
No,
yes,
we have
I
no
do.
Idea.
Yes, okay, I do. Ahead. Okay. Here is Steve Ferguson weighing in on American politics.
The big fundraiser for hosted by Gwyneth Paltrow. Gwyneth Paltrow told the. He was so handsome she couldn't speak properly. I'm like, I wish would get a little bit more handsome so she would shut up forever. How's that?
Yeah. That was Craig Ferguson. We made a mistake there in the script.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's not
For
your fault.
For whom did Gwyneth Paltrow hold a fundraiser?
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That is an excellent guess, by the way.
Do you think he's that? Do you think Gwyneth Paltrow would find him stunningly handsome?
I don't know. What her tastes are, really.
All right, we're gonna go to you, ma'am, over here.
You have any idea?
Yeah, you think who might Gwyneth Paltrow might find
stunningly handsome?
It's a politician that needs a fundraiser.
Who do I find? I'm trying to.
What politician do you find attractive?
Stunningly.
You know there aren't very many.
Well, who might be at the top of that very short
list? He's got
list?
A nice smile.
He's got an ear thing going. He's got a nice smile. Does that help you or no?
Not so much.
He would be the president of the United States.
Oh,
he would be Barack Obama, which we find to be very attractive. Now, here's a bonus question for you, Chuck.
Hold on. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Here's
the
bonus question. This is a Gwyneth Paltrow question.
Yes, it is.
If you can name, Chuck, because we're feeling bad for you in the points thing here, you're the ringmaster of the circus.
This is a hard question, Jim. Yeah.
If you can name the candidate running for governor of Massachusetts, he's one of the five, whose brother is dating Gwyneth Paltrow, we will give you, don't be upset, Sarah, you get 2 points, not just one. Do you have any idea who it is?
I do not.
If I gave you his first name, let's see if you could say. His first name is Evan. Does that help you out?
And he's got something to do with American Horror Story,
His brother too. Does. No, it doesn't help you out?
Nope.
Well, that's not a very good sign for your campaign, Evan Falchuk. Thank you very much. Give me the 2 points. Thank you very much.
We think he should have Gwyneth Paltrow coming to Massachusetts to campaign for him, and then he might get a little bit more attention than he's getting right now.
Now, judges, do I have time for another question for Sarah before the bonus round? I do. Here it is, Sarah. You ready? What's the score, by the way, judges, please, because we are paying no attention to this. 3-1. Sarah, 3-1? Sarah, you can open an even wider lead here. Is he your boss or not? Is he your boss?
And technically speaking,
yeah,
in this moment, yes.
Yes. Oh,
best
okay.
friend, boss, whatever.
Yeah, you better watch out. Better watch out.
Now, a Florida gubernatorial debate between Republican incumbent Rick Scott and his Democratic challenger, former Governor Charlie Crist, kicked off in a very bizarre way this week. Please listen.
Governor Crist has asked to have a small place underneath his podium. The rules of the debate that I was shown by the Scott campaign say that there should be no somehow there is a there, and for that reason, ladies and gentlemen, I am being told that Governor Scott will not join us for this debate.
By the way, this is a totally true story. Scott, the incumbent, was saying he wasn't going to participate in the debate because Chris, the former governor running against him, was violating a rule. What was the offending object, Sarah, underneath Charlie Crist podium?
A fan.
That is correct.
Yep.
Okay. Wow. Why did he care about there being a fan? It was just an excuse to get out of the debate.
Yeah.
Who cared about
like, turn
fan?
It off?
It seemed very childish the whole
time.
I mean, let's try it here. Chuck, had there been a fan under your part of the counter, would you not have shown up for this quiz?
No, I would have been
with Sarah Honeywell, you would have been fine.
I would have appreciated one. I think hair blowing, you know.
Exactly. Well, I thought it was like a 6-inch, you know, stool that would make one candidate look that much taller than the other candidate. Maybe they would use that as an unfair advantage.
Was it a big fan? Was it a little fan?
We have no idea. Chuck, are you a circus family kind of guy? I mean, a lot of circus.
I do not come from circus.
How'd you get into this deal?
Kind of accidentally. I decided to start the band, Emperor Norton Stationary Marching Band, almost 8 years ago now. And it was always sort of a performance concept band with circus performers every time the band performed. And eventually the circus performers sort of developed and made the switch to professional and semi-professional performers. And so we made the Circus Guild out of that. And before I knew it, I had a circus, and it's been great ever since.
Now, Sarah, since you are
before
a trombone
I knew it, I had a circus.
Player in this Emperor Norton Stationary Marching Band, we have to ask you the crucial question here about the Emperor Norton Stationary Marching Band. Is it stationary, marching, or both?
It's a little bit of both.
A little bit of both.
Yep. Okay. We do events that are both wandering around outside, wandering around inside, standing still inside. Okay. Always a dance party.
You know, do you remember, I don't know if you've seen this movie, when we were still allowed to laugh at Woody Allen, I don't know if you've seen the movie. Is this Take the Money and Run, where he plays, is it a bass fiddle or a cello? He's in a marching band.
I don't remember.
He plays two notes, picks up the chair, runs ahead to catch up with the marching band, puts the chair down again in place. Well, I thought it was funny anyway. Okay, here is
marching
our bonus.
Cello.
What's the score now, judges? Is it 4-1, 5? What is it?
I'm being
crushed. It's back to 3.5-1. Apparently you did something, Sarah, that caused you to lose a half a point. I don't know what it was. Now, here, you still have a chance, Chuck. Don't be, I can see you're pretty upset about this. Since you're both performing in a circus act, we're going to ask you about another staple of circus acts, and that, of course, is the clown. In this case, I'm sure you guessed this, it is Krusty the Clown from The Simpsons, okay?
Okay.
Now, you'll start with Sarah
this time. I'm
going
to go to Sarah this time, and I should point out, as I always do, that these questions are really hard multiple-choice questions.
No, they're not.
And everybody gets them wrong, so
not
don't feel
hard
bad.
At all. Go ahead.
Okay. Here we go. Krusty the Clown got his start as a street mime. After his career took off, he found that he had a daughter. How did he meet her mother? A, she was a makeup artist for Hollywood Squares. He met her when he was on the show. B, she was a soldier in the Gulf War. He met her when he was entertaining the troops. Or C, he met her through J-Date.
Oh, wow.
Hollywood Squares, Gulf War, or J-Date?
Hollywood Squares?
Mm-mm.
No.
You want to take a guess, Chuck?
Come on, Chuck. We're both rooting for you here.
C?
Nope.
How about B? You want to guess B?
She was a soldier.
How about B?
Gulf War. Okay.
Okay, now here you go. Chuck, I'm asking you a question.
It was
we're going to give you, if you get this right, 2.5 points, which will probably tie things up going into the final question. Krusty owns the restaurant franchise Krusty Burger, which was shut down by the Board of Health for one of three reasons. Tell me which one. A, instead of soft serve ice cream, he was serving pink slime. B, his Shamrock Burger was made with moldy hamburger buns. Or C, he stapled half-eaten hamburgers together to make new ones. Which is it, A, B, or C, please?
C.
That is
correct.
Right, and it is tie. Yes. Now, Sarah, let me explain the rules here. Since it is tie, Marjorie's going to ask you a question. If you get it right, you go home the winner, even though he is your boss and close friend. If you get it wrong, he goes home the winner. Do you understand?
Yeah.
It's a winner take all or nothing kind of thing. Marjorie.
Okay. Krusty is a multimillionaire who spends his money as fast as he earns it. How does he waste his money? A, on lawsuits. B, bathing in Remy Martin cognac. Or C, lighting fireworks with $100 bills.
Take all the time you need. This is the one that's going to decide the outcome.
Oh, no.
A, B, or C?
Probably A.
Is that right, judges?
You are correct.
Wow.
Lawsuits.
Congratulations.
Very, very good. Very, very good.
So how do we find
you
guys?
How do we find
What's the website? What's the deal?
BostonCircusGuild.com is where you can find out all about the Boston Circus Guild. You get tickets to Cirque of the Dead via the American Repertory Theater website. Search for Cirque of the Dead. We've got 4 nights, 8 shows. So there's lots of opportunities. It's not just on Halloween. It's also the week before Halloween. So,
is this for all ages? Or is it?
This is not an all-age circus.
I didn't think so.
This is a very adult intense.
Is it adult 18 or 21?
It's 18 plus.
It's 18
yes,
plus.
It is. And one of the few 18 plus venues you can
so
go see anything like this.
Blood, gore, and sex.
Blood, gore, and sex. Yes, in a nutshell.
In that order or what? Oh, boy, Sarah's the most excited to be in the whole quiz.
So we mix and match them pretty liberally.
Really?
Yeah. And when where is the band in these performances? Are you on the stage, off the stage, orchestra pit?
Well, for Emperor Norton, we're going to be kind of mixed in, I think, with everybody. There's going to be another band, Johnny Blazes and the Pretty Boys, the first week, which will be more stationary on stage. They're like their soul, soul group.
And how many people are going to be in this event, this gore event?
Oh, wow. The cast is about 25 people.
Wow.
And each band is 14 to 16 people.
Gosh, it
sounds great.
Big spectacular.
The venue is also great. It's a great place.
Yes, we love working
Square.
There.
It's
definitely
fabulous.
Going to be unlike anything people
well,
have
you know,
seen before.
I've been to the ART a couple of times, and sometimes you see some incredible acrobats, and I wonder if they have anything to do with you guys.
No, we've sourced some of our performers
to
different things. It's been really interesting the way the ART has been integrating a lot of other disciplines into theater.
Yeah. Do me a favor, though. You were great, by the way, Chuck. But next time you come, forget the trombone player. We want a contortionist. Is that okay?
Next time.
I'm sorry, Sarah. You were good. We've never had a contortionist,
contortionist
in the studio. Thank you.
Okay.
Pleasure, gentlemen, lady. Thank you so much.
Chuck Lusheen Jr. is the founder and creative director of the Boston Circus Guild, as well as Epper Norton's stationary marching band. I love the name of that. Sarah Honeywell plays trombone in the aforementioned Emperor Norton's
stationary marching band. They're both performing in Cirque of the Dead. It's at Club Oberon, October 23rd through the end of the month. And as we said, sex, blood, and gore sounds very
Doesn't
fun.
Doesn't get much better than that.
Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in for Politics on Monday. We're going to be joined by the Reverends Emmett Price and Irene Monroe for All Revved Up. Our show's a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Rose of Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and Alan Mattis, our engineer.
And are the first one-on-one debate in the governor's contest Tuesday night, GBH and GBH Radio 89.7. Marjorie and I will moderate. See you Monday.
Bye.